whenever everybody on the elevator with me is lower than me, I feel this weird sense of accomplishment. I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm going to floor 12, and you douches are all getting off on lower floors. I'm so much better than you, right?
Escomission.
Roll for host.
Rolling.
For host.
Generate. 6.
15.
14.
Oh.
God damn.
Sweet.
I've had such a drought.
I don't know. That was pretty close, though. All right. Well, I won the roll, so I am the host this week for the Escort Mission Podcast. Welcome to you who have come to listen. My name is Mike, and I'm here, as always, with Chaz and Josh. Say hello, guys.
Hello.
What's up?
All right. Sweet. Well, now we got those pleasantries out of the way. Let's go into our 30th show.
Cool. Holy shit. Nice.
We've been doing this 29 other times. Did anybody actually think, I'm just for a second, or did you actually think we would still be doing this? How many did you think we'd get to before we gave up on this?
Five.
Five? What about you, Charles?
You know, I did not think about it. I can't say that I had a thought before. I knew that I was quite committed.
I thought
and
two.
I really wanted us to do it seriously, and I think I said that when we were originally tossing around the idea, which I believe you, Mike, first presented.
That is true.
I wanted to make sure we did one every week. I'm like, right. If we're going to do it, we have to do it every week, and we kind of stuck to that for a while, and definitely have not in weeks past.
Life.
But, yeah.
You know.
Even so. I kind of thought we'd keep doing it.
Once every week or two, yeah.
But because we just sit around and bullshit about this stuff anyway.
Like, yeah. It's just a matter of getting you over here and turning on mics. That's really the only difference. But
yeah.
No, I think now that we've done 30, we could easily get to 50 or 100. Like, I can see that happening now. So that's pretty cool. I'm really happy because I wasn't sure. I thought we might do it once.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're like, well, that was cool. And then never do it again.
So it's the it's the discrete quantity that we need to celebrate, not like the amount of time that we've done it.
That's also relevant.
Like, once we've done it a year, is that better or worse than once we've done 50 episodes or something?
I think they are separately impressive. And we get to celebrate both anniversaries.
I agree.
Add up the cumulative hours recorded
and podcasted, posted,
and then it's like a slash played in an MMO.
Yeah.
So you're like, we have now slash recorded 500 hours.
Right.
Yeah, which is not hard for us since each of these shows are super long.
We might be able to hit within 50.
I mean, it's probably like 60 hours.
We've done about 60 or 70 hours of podcasting.
Nice.
Rad. So. You could have either listened to this whole thing or played Final Fantasy VIII.
Yep, think about that.
Or both think at the same time in a bizarre soundtrack experiment.
Yes. All right, well, in honor of our 30th show, we have a hellacious amount of mailbag.
Mailbag.
Hit it.
Mailbag. Mailbag. We're going to open the mailbag. Bag.
Mail.
Bag.
Mail.
All right. So start us off, Josh, with our first.
All right. So we mailbag. Got a lot of email, and we're going to have to do some clipping, some pairing. So we got a good one from John Cox, and he talks about the thrift store song, which is awesome. And
did you guys Nakamura listen to that? Lewis, I did listen to it.
And he talks. I didn't listen to it.
No. You suck.
So it was. I failed my homework assignment.
So it was good. Well produced. I'm not like an instant fan, but it was definitely solid.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the most commercial of his.
It was good.
He talks about Black and White, and he just goes through the whole
Michael
campaign.
Jackson pop song from the 90s?
No. he talks about all this like animal torture that happens in the game that I apparently either forgot or
cast out of your mind.
Or like maybe I didn't get that far.
Or maybe you just didn't engage in it.
Because
right?
Maybe I didn't, because it is like a sim, and you know how like sometimes you just play, like in a GTA, you'll just run around and steal cars.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think when I played Black and White, I just did the simmy stuff for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember like the levels or beating it. I don't think if there is a beating it.
Mm-hmm.
He says there's discrete levels and different stuff happens to your minion and it gets like kidnapped and like crazy stuff, man. Everything he's talking about sounds
sounds totally Molyneux.
Yeah,
to make Molyneux. You develop a huge relationship with this thing and then kidnap it.
Yeah,
yeah. You. John made it seem really interesting, like way more interesting than I thought it was.
Sounds cool. It almost makes you want to go back and play all those levels. But then he talks about AC3 and it's or AC2 actually, because you know that's the one he's playing. Mm-hmm. And we haven't really talked about this a lot. Maybe we mentioned it a little bit, but it's, you know, he brings up the point that it's fucking easy, that all the jumping puzzles, they give you like more than twice as much time as you need to do them, and it's almost impossible to fail a jump. And when you do fail a jump, it doesn't necessarily feel like it's your fault. It's just like the game input mechanic mistake. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost just like he's playing an interactive novel or something. Hmm. And then his other point is...
So that's interesting because there actually has already been a patch to AC3 that made some stuff easier. People were complaining that I think specifically some chase sections. And I just did my first chase section and found it pretty damn easy. So I think that... That might have been one of the sections that they made easier with this patch. But yeah, you know, 2 weeks after the game came out, people had complained enough that they patched the game to make some of the stuff
freaking
less hard.
Players.
I'm really curious what they patched, because
the ones I read about were chases. So you can think about the times when you're chasing.
I did have one chase that was kind of dumb. Yeah, I had one chase that I failed repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like impossible. It was just. I think you really had to repeat it like 6 times until you got lucky.
Yeah.
Because there's enough randomness that I just got lucky at some point. The dude ran into a pedestrian and got slowed down, and then I was able to catch up. But I was executing at least one of these chases like totally perfectly, repeatedly, and failing it. I remember that.
Yeah.
Hopefully they fixed that. But that's just a little tweak. But I think his point is pretty valid. The combat... I don't even remember health potions. He says there's like 15 no cooldown health potions in AC2 in this one fight that he had, which made it crazy easy.
I don't remember that at all.
I don't remember that at all either.
How funny.
You know, it was a while ago. But I generally agree with him. I think the jumping shit is pretty easy. The combat is pretty easy. And when it's not easy, it's just annoying. And in general, it's an easy game. But I do think that AC3 improves the combat to the extent that it's more interesting, even if not super challenging. Mm-hmm. And it's more like visually engaging and stuff, even if it's not super challenging. But there is a little bit of challenge there, maybe a little more. But then the... you know, that's just what you get with this
game.
That's
what it's about. It's never...
Yeah.
I think he's right that it's not a hard game.
So is it about making you feel like a badass more than trying to pose a challenge?
It's about that. Yeah. And for me, it's about the worlds. I like those games because I love to inhabit those worlds and, you know, feel like I'm in Renaissance Italy and like, this is so cool. And I bet this is what it was really like, even though it probably wasn't anything like that, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I go to it for. I don't really go to Assassin's Creed for a huge, huge challenge. I just liked, you know, let's see, you know, how this game does its take on that the same story. Like, I guess that Assassin's Creed, Halo 4, Assassin's Creed in general, Halo in general, and Mass Effect in general all have kind of the same story. They were making this point on the Bombcast recently that it's all the same, like, there are aliens, and they were super intelligent, but then you find out that they weren't really, and it was kind of a problem that some of the things that they did, they all have, like, this exact same kind of high-level story arc to them. So I just want to see how Assassin's Creed is handling that story, you know?
Hmm. One other thing that he mentions is that he tends to run up various pieces of terrain that he'd rather not run up.
Yes, it's very easy to do that.
Now, I think this has been an issue in every Assassin's Creed to an extent for everyone that plays. And my solution, ready? More controller buttons.
What?
The problem is that they make the right trigger both sprint and climb, right? So they train you.
That is only now. Previous games did not do that.
Well, how did it work in AC2?
AC2, the A button was a toggle between, or a press and hold, to move between low profile and high profile mode.
So right? You hold it in high profile.
You hold it to be in high profile
now,
mode.
Now, quote, high profile means climb.
No.
Means jump.
It means...
high profile.
You will climb if you are... No, you'll climb if you just walk up to something, right, and press up.
No, you won't.
Or and right trigger, maybe. So if you're just walking around, here's how high profile worked in every game up until now, excepting potentially one, because I'm not sure how one did it. Low profile, you're just walking around, right? You just press forward, you walk slowly. You start holding A, you walk faster, and you're in a high profile mode. And if you walk by someone while holding A, you would pickpocket them. Right, so you're in like a little higher profile mode. If you are not holding A and you pull right trigger, you start to run, but it's kind of like a slow jog. And then if you hold right trigger and hold the A button, then you're full on sprint, free run, jumping over shit, you know, zooming around as fast as you can.
Okay, but you can't climb unless you hold A.
I believe that's true.
Because climbing is a high profile activity.
That makes sense.
Yeah. You wouldn't just walk.
Yep.
You know, casually up, and you wouldn't jog casually up a building, right?
Agree. So that sounds pretty awesome, actually.
So anyway, whatever the specifics are, the gist is they're combining the act of climbing mm-hmm. with the act of moving quickly, right? With the same button mm-hmm. or collection of buttons, right? And these are two like logical things that need to be separated, in my opinion, in order to eliminate the accidental climbing issue. Because all the time in either of these games, you're trained to like hold these fucking button downs, mm-hmm. these buttons down, in order to just sprint and get around as fast as you can.
Yep.
But you don't always want to run up like a banister you're trying to run by,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
But he's such a great climber that he just totally wants to run up banisters.
Yes.
Because you're holding the run up everything button.
Yes.
Yeah. So more buttons, separate. But they oversimplify to make it easy.
And I
so they think
that...
that would, you know, cause more trouble than...
Yeah, the issue was that your highest movement speed also correlates, even when they had the A button, the high profile button, your highest movement speed also means you're going to attempt to climb everything.
Right.
And so they still weren't doing it right, even when they had an additional button involved, and yet they further simplified. And yeah, I mean, so in one aspect, I like what they did. Now that you don't have to hold the A button, A is like safe and unsafe in 3, right? If you just hold the right trigger, you'll move as fast as you can. You'll move at your top movement speed. And if you're jumping between obstacles, he will only jump if he can make it, basically.
Yeah.
He'll only take safe jumps. If you're holding the A button, then he will take an unsafe jump, one where he doesn't have an immediate target point to land on.
Yeah, right trigger is run and jump and don't die.
Yeah.
And right trigger and A is like run and jump no matter whether or not you're going to die.
Yeah.
So it is interesting distinction.
But maybe not die because there's a guy right behind you.
Yeah, it's quite the change from AC2, which is high profile, low profile versus AC3 where it's like risky to your death or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And anyway. It was kind of cute that they have the Animus that supposedly has firmware that they can like fall back on for these changes, like, oh, we changed your HUD around, or they literally like refer to the HUD that he's seeing as he plays out these, you know, genetic memories, and, you know, we gave it a firmware update, so now you won't, you know, jump off things all the time or whatever. You know, they actually reference the mechanical differences.
Yeah, I love that. Cortana does that in Halo 4 also.
Yeah.
As soon as you start... she's like, I upgraded your firmware, so that's why like your visor HUD looks different.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Something like that. It's pretty cute. All right. Next mailbag, I'm going to do Richard's.
Go for it.
Okay. Richard told us a bunch of interesting stuff. His child is apparently a fucking prodigy.
he did not say that, but...
That's the gist. He's playing Forza with a manual transmission.
Yeah.
And he's how old?
Apparently. I think he's like 3.
He's 3? Yeah.
3. I can't even use a manual. That's how awesome that is.
That's awesome. He points out that Forza Horizon, because we didn't say it specifically, Forza Horizon wasn't developed by Turn 10. It was developed by Playground Games, but they got the physics and, mm-hmm. and code and stuff. And then he points out that Master Chief did talk some in the previous Halos, but not a lot. And
did he say gruff and stern things? One would imagine.
I think so. I mean, that's why I don't think I was too shocked when
I like flowers.
When he says gruff and stern things. Also, he defends Toe Jam and Earl and says that it's awesome, and he just played it with his son again. Now, I just want to say I wasn't like ripping Toe Jam and Earl intentionally last week in the sense that it is a bad game. I was just saying, like, it seemed like the poor man's Earthworm Jim.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't play it, like, at all. I just knew it had a similar art style and it looked dumb. I didn't like the art style. What did you guys think?
I didn't play it either. I played Earthworm Jim.
Right. So I'm the only one who actually played it and can form a real opinion about it. Yeah. And you still
oh no,
thought
I can
I
definitely
wrong.
Have an opinion about it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I still formed an opinion. Yeah.
Well, I mean, okay, but a more legitimate. Like, actual with some experience opinion. Like, I played the game for 10 minutes. And
well, now it's 2v2. Richard's on your side. Right.
No, but I said it was a bad game, so...
Oh, never mind.
No, I said it was bad.
Sorry, Richard, you're still outnumbered.
Yeah, no. I don't agree that it was a good game. I think it was
one
uninformed
and two... sorry, one informed and two uninformed opinions here. Outnumber.
It was funky, though. It's a funky game.
I'd give it that.
Dude,
I would give it 4 out of 5 funks.
You remember when funky was like the hottest thing you could be in the late 90s? So funky.
Any bunch that you were in,
oh,
if it
man.
Was funky, then that was
seriously.
The bunch. Brady Bunch, out. Funky Bunch, in.
For sure.
Yeah. All right, so thanks, Richard. Thanks, John. Charles, you have a letter to read.
I do. It's for my mom.
Do it.
She asks... Thinking forward, what hardware innovations would you like developed to improve gameplay? Currently, there are heavy constraints due to the need for consoles, control mechanisms, and displays. What would you like to do away with? She goes on to mention things like rings on your fingers as a gameplay input device, projected screens that you could carry with you and have anywhere, or you know, goggles to project the game in front of or literally into your eyes. Ideally, the less interaction with the mechanism there is, the more human the experience and the less intrusive the learning curve. What would be the best gaming apparatus in 20 years?
This is your mom.
This is my mom, yeah.
Yeah. She teaches at Montessori
yes.
schools.
Yes. She so operates in Montessori school.
Operates. So you can totally tell, like, that's her perspective, is she wants a low learning curve. Mm-hmm. She wants an easy barrier to entry.
Interesting. You say low learning curve, but you're using that backwards.
Oh, am I?
Everyone uses learning curve backwards. It's one of those things that is totally counterintuitive. This is completely unrelated to my mom's letter, but the learning curve is the axes of information gained on the x-axis and the x-axis is time.
Doesn't make sense.
Right.
The yeah, x-axis yeah. is time, and the y-axis is information retained yeah. or
you would want a high
something.
Learning curve.
So a sharp learning curve means you get a lot of information quickly. So a high learning curve, but we always say a low learning curve because if it's a low slope, it sounds easier, right? So everybody misuses it, and it's so much so that if you say it the other way, people mistake what you mean. But
yeah, you're basically wrong. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
That is not common parlance.
It definitely is not common parlance, but it's the origin of the term and like the original paper in which the idea of a learning curve was you know put forth like in 1950 or something.
All right, yeah. point taken. But the she basically wants you know she's curious about a low barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think Kinect is probably well theoretically one of the lowest barrier to entry like mechanisms to play a game because it's like a camera with infrared shit that you stand in front of and it just detects you and you just move and you don't hold anything, you don't learn buttons. But the problem so far is that it's not high resolution enough to detect your individual fingers or mm-hmm. even be that accurate
yeah.
with all your joints. It's pretty decent for the like first gen. But when they come out with the Kinect 2 with the Xbox 720 or whatever, right, inevitably, hopefully it's high enough res and stuff that, you know, it's closer to that goal. But, because of the low res, et cetera, issue, there's also, like, this barrier to entry, which is you learning how to interact with these arbitrary mechanisms of waving your hands. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not just like stand and play this game in this intuitive way. It's like stand in front and learn exactly how to swipe your hand, which to mean confirm or start game.
Yes, right.
You know,
right.
Hold your palm up in the right area and then move it further up to learn where the weird hand cursor on the screen should actually be.
It's like an abstract mapping, you know.
It's almost as hard as or harder than like using a mouse on a computer or something.
And what about, I mean, what do you think about touchscreens? I mean, touchscreens, won't they be around in 20 years
intuitive.
And won't they be dominant?
Touchscreens are crazy intuitive.
Yeah.
They really are.
I mean, it's touch. It's like the first thing you do when you're alive.
Natural
probably,
user
is like
interface.
Touch something and
I think, I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff to think about here. You know, she says the less interaction with a mechanism there is, the more human the experience. And that's probably true, but gaming isn't, you know, I don't think we're necessarily after a human experience, right? So maybe that's true from a user interface perspective. If you just want to use...
What kind of experience are we looking for? An alien experience?
A fun experience. Right. Okay.
And what do you mean by human experience? Or what do you think she means by that?
I think she means more natural, more intuitive.
So
less...
like a controller or a Wiimote makes it less human because now you have to learn this mechanical...
Well, I would say a Wiimote is more human than a controller. And a touchscreen is more human than a Wiimote. Right, but a Wiimote, I mean, they sold a million Wiimotes to senior centers because it's super intuitive. You pick it up and you swing it like a tennis racket, and the tennis guy swings his tennis racket. You know, there was very close, you know, 1-to-1 movement and for those types of games, it's great, right? It's a great Wii bowling controller. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a great. Have fun with this game, unless it's those specific gameplay actions, which don't make for, you know, 20-hour long experiences, right? You don't want to be doing that over 20 hours. And
piloting a tank, for example.
Yeah, what gamers are typically after, what I'm after in a game, is to be able to do a lot of things, and you kind of need a lot of control inputs, and I also want to have fun doing it. I want to either be engrossed or relaxed or, you know, some combination of the two, but I don't want to be like physically exhausted by the end of it, right? Thinking about how to play Assassin's Creed if it were a Kinect game makes it sound really... So until we're at the point where it's like, okay, I plug the jack into the back of my head I get to, you know, go into and inhabit the Matrix where I can do all this cool shit, you know, but I don't get exhausted doing it or something, you know. Until we're there, then it's these kind of intermediate steps are probably difficult to deal with.
Hmm. I agree. To some extent, you know, as hardcore gamers or whatever, our tendency is to say that Wiimote type or Kinect type interfaces are for noobs, and the more deeply involved experiences can be had with an advanced controller input mechanism, mm-hmm. which is why I'm talking about more buttons and stuff, yeah. right? But I like the theory of advancing input mechanisms to be more intuitive or more interesting or whatever, and that a couple of the next advances in technology in that department that I think, you know, I'm looking forward to that nobody's really implemented in a great way yet. One of them, or it's kind of like the same thing, but either holographic projection, mm-hmm. like we always see in movies where the star map in the board of a ship.
Mm-hmm. Like Mass Effect.
Anything in the center is always this thing in the middle of the table that pops up and yep. is three-dimensional. And we don't have those in real life yet, right? Because you have to like spray fog up into the air right. and then shoot a projector at the fog. Or do, like, weird shit, right? And the other option to get something like that is, like, augmented reality glasses combined mm-hmm. with cameras or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, we have augmented reality on, like, the Vita or the iPad and shit like that, yep. where you aim the camera on the device at your table,
yep.
and then it detects the table and maybe a card you put on the table or something like that, and then you look at the screen instead of looking at the table.
Right.
And on the screen, you see, like, actual... game characters hanging out on your table.
Yep.
And there's a bunch of games that do this, and they're super cool, either with cards or nothing on the table. But they're so unintuitive and weird, because you have to hold this thing up and point it at the table and then look at the screen. You can't look at the table.
Yeah.
So when that...
It puts you at a little bit of a distance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when that combines with like a Google Glass or Oculus Rift type of, you know, video screen in front of your eyes so that you're looking through a HUD screen at the table.
Yeah.
And then it has a camera and it just superimposes the augmented reality shit on top of what you're already looking at.
That's a big deal.
Then everyone is seeing the same, if they're all wearing the glasses, are seeing the same like holographic thing without actually having to project it into 3D space. It's only being projected in front of your your glasses.
So if you guys
I'm super stoked for that shit.
If you want to check out a cool sort of visualization of what things would look like if that were a real capability...
Google Glass has a pretty good demo of somebody walking around town and doing social and emails.
Yes,
crap,
and but what and they're showing
mapping and stuff.
What but they're it's showing not, there is not quite the same because
yeah, it's not quite there.
What they're showing. Well, first of all, that's like a previz, like a not a real demo, right? So that's like what we're thinking about doing, and none of that is actually tied to the world. That's the difference. What it once the glasses. Can actually, they can see for themselves and they can put stuff up between your eyeball and the thing you're looking at and like have an arrow pointing to a physical thing. And like the overlay matters, like specifically where it's like this door is the one that you need to go into, or you know, take this bike path and it'll actually show up in the correct lane and stuff like that. That'll be really cool, but that takes a tremendous amount of processing power, right? Like you need huge computers to be able to, as fast as you can turn your head to have it. Keep up with you know where your vision is and do all that calculation is really difficult, but that will be super awesome. But there's a movie, there's like a little 10-minute short film called Sight, S-I-G-H-T, that is
that is a good movie.
Yeah, so set in you know whatever the kind of near future, like 30-40 years out.
Yeah,
either contact lenses or implants that overlay stuff. Great visualizations of what the kind of how kind of almost anything can become a video game once you're doing that. There's a guy who's cooking or he's going to cook dinner, right? And he's chopping up a cucumber and he plays, you know, Cucumber Hero and it outlines little lines on the, you know, superimposes them over the cucumber so he knows exactly where to slice and then he like misses a slice and it gives him minus points for doing that and, you know, so then he's like, okay, I'm going to start over with a new cucumber and try to get it right,
and,
you know.
And that was cool. And I like I could see that happening and actually be interested in something like that. But the other part of that film, which has to do with the social interaction, that is where I'm not quite so on board with it.
It's like, cool parts.
Treating
and then
a
it
date
gets
like a game.
Kind of rapey at the end. And you're like,
well, it's just, it's like, well, I think my take on this is that, I don't know where we'll be in 20 years. I'm not sure if we'll be in either of those potential futures that you guys talk about. And like, I would be perfectly happy if we were playing video games roughly like we're playing them now in 20 years. Like, and I you know, I would still be happy if I was holding a controller, looking at a screen, playing an engaging experience. You know, I don't need holograms or Google glasses. I mean, I think it will still be fun even when I'm 50 doing that. I think. I'm not saying that I'm against doing those things. Those seem cool, but I'm not sure that they're necessary to make it engaging.
No, they're, you know? I mean, I don't think they're necessary, but it's one of those things
like...
Or
if it'll even become the thing, like that will be normal.
We would probably have said the same thing about telephones, right?
Right.
You know, if we were our age 30 years ago going like, yeah, it would be cool if we had a phone that you took with you all the time and you could make a call from anywhere, but really there are payphones on every corner and there's always one in the office, so what do you need? You know?
I think the difference, though, is maybe that comparison is not as good as, say, like a book. Books, like a story on a printed page, yeah, they've moved to an ebook, but I guess the concept of just you're reading a book and their stories and plot and you get engaged have not really changed since the book was invented. And that way, I guess, you know, that way to get a story, that way to engage in a narrative could be happening in video games 20 years from now. But I'm hoping in 20 years that we won't even talk about, like, it won't even be a question of, like, you know, oh, the story's bullshit and you don't have to worry about that, but the gameplay's good. Like, I'm hoping that, like, story will be as important, and that will be more the norm rather than right now where it's better, but I still think that that's just, like, probably the most neglected part of it, because that's not really what sells most high-profile video games. Like, that's the Calls of Duty of the world are not being sold on their story.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think that's a good point.
I think that could reasonably be improved and become more normal rather than just the technology in which we play these games.
And there should be, sorry for sort of cutting you off there, Josh. There, I think, is going to be a class of writer who grows up thinking about and writing specifically for video games, for interactive fiction, for, you know, not just producing one storyline. Right. And that's one of the problems I think that screenwriters have. They say, like, oh, we hired this high profile screenwriter to come write our video game, and they never turn out to be that great or that much better than any others, because it, you know, the whole one of the great values of writing for an interactive medium is that you can have branching storylines. And so it's not just thinking up one great, you know, plot and delivering it. It's thinking up one great plot and how to artfully give the impression of a huge amount of player choice, you know, and games are starting to do that.
Yeah.
You know, Heavy Rain does that.
It's just much harder to do that, so.
It's much harder, and it's a different skill set.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different skill set. Yeah. You're absolutely right. And it might take a generation of people that grew up playing these games to then become the creators of the better ones, you know?
Yeah.
Yes, excellent point, Mike. I agree that it's... To us, it's almost like a more important goal that just, like, the existing hardcore games just get better, right? Just have better stories and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, take her point that to lower the barrier to entry to everyone else that isn't really experiencing the games we are.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of factors involved, and one of them is the input mechanism. Yeah. But specifically speaking to the story thing that you're talking about, you know, I just played Halo 4. And I loved the combat. It's just great. And I love the visual art. It's just gorgeous. I love the sound. It sounds fucking phenomenal. And yet the story, pretty disappointing, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, there's another alien race that you have to kill.
Yeah.
Right?
They came before. You know?
Like, the same hero that you were in the last five games, you are him again shooting aliens.
And it's kind of the same aliens. Like, there are some new aliens, but there's all the same aliens that you've been shooting for four games
and
also are there.
You know, even if you get deeper into the plot, though, it's still recycling similar, you know, these heavily used tropes in sci-fi storytelling. Yeah. And so I got, you know, whenever I play a game like that and I'm missing the story, I end up going back and reading. So I spent most of the week reading and not gaming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading Reamde, which is just so good, and that I plowed through like 700 pages of it in the last week.
Nice. Okay. So we had one more mailbag. This is an epic mailbag, you guys.
Yeah, well done. Thanks, listeners.
Yes.
Up top, listeners.
This is exactly what we asked for.
Podcast high five.
So there's another podcast that I've mentioned personally many times on the show. It's called the Experience Points Podcast. They just did their 200th episode recently. Mm. And they sort of did a retrospective on their whole podcast.
Yes, but have they hit the 70-hour mark? Because they are fucking short, right?
They're about 30, 40 minutes, so I think so, yeah.
I bet we're going to pass them up in total length pretty soon.
I think so. If we do another 10 shows, we probably will, yeah. So one of the guys, the two guys who do the podcast, their names are Scott Juster and George Albor. So I wrote two experience points because I've been listening to them for a while, and I just wanted to say that I enjoyed their podcast. And George actually wrote me back. And paraphrasing what he said, thanks for listening. I'm so glad to hear our little show offers any small piece of inspiration for your own work. I told him that, you know, I worked on a podcast and, you know, theirs was a bit of an inspiration. He also went on to say, I'm all for more podcasts and creative works in general. In fact, I subscribe to your show. Listening to it now, in fact, funny stuff. So, just like that, I sent an email to someone, and they started listening to our podcast. Apparently, I need to send email to people more often, because I didn't think it was that easy. So, that's really cool.
What's up, George?
Yeah, thanks for listening, George.
Podcast five.
I hope you're enjoying this. I retroactively apologize for all the times that I mentioned your podcast and said that it was shitty, but in a funny, ironic way, because that's our thing. Please keep listening to the podcast.
He probably never heard that, though.
Yeah, oops.
Yeah, now he's going to go through.
I'll edit this out. So anyway, thanks for listening to the podcast. Keep on doing your show. It's also a good podcast that you talk about stuff on. and that's mailbag.
Sweet. Let's, epic mailbag.
We need a closing up the mailbag
We're
song.
We're closing the mailbag.
Because we did it too soon.
Mail.
All right. There you go. All right. So let's get into what we've actually been working on. I'm going to head it off with a quick note, which is sort of because of Josh starting that whole meme of the week thing. I'm going to mention a random thing that was cool on the internet. There's this guy named Tommy Edison. He's apparently known as the blind film critic. I don't really know how that works. Apparently he's a film critic, but he's also blind. So that's an interesting perspective. He put up a couple videos recently, one where he was talking about how he was trying to understand the concept of color and other people explaining to him what color was and the ways they were trying to, you know, use metaphor that, oh, red is, you know, fire and blue is, you know, water and the ocean and stuff like that. But, you know, he... As good as seeing people might think that that is a good way to explain color to someone, uh-huh. It is ultimately a failure because he has never seen anything and it holds no concept. I don't know. It was interesting way to think, hey, how would you describe color to someone? How would you describe what the ocean sounds like to someone who, you know, maybe can't hear or something like that? Or I don't know. It was interesting. He also did a
video. Also interesting to think about what... those kind of challenges in communication were we to contact some sort of alien race, like same types of issues, right? Assuming we all inhabit the same physical universes, they probably have some kind of senses in common, but they may have senses that are totally out of the range. Even, you know, other animals on Earth have senses that we don't have, right? They're birds. Did you know this? There are raptors that can see into the infrared range and can literally see the rising heat thermals. They can see them and fly in them, and that's how they know where they are to you know, gain altitude when they're flying next to a mountain and stuff like that. It's fucking nuts.
Wow, like pilot wings. That's
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Totally. There's it was a fabulous radio lab that talks about the you know, the different cones or
rods and cones to
see different colors, and then other animals that have more expanded color ranges.
Yeah,
and I think they just go progressively like more and more expanded, and then birds are pretty good, and then there's this shrimp that has like 26.
It's like an order of magnitude.
Yeah, 26 types of cones and can see so deep into like ultraviolet.
Yeah,
can't range, play video so games though.
Super.
Nope. I suppose. So it's pretty useless. Can't play video games. Can't listen to our podcast.
Suck, shrimp.
Can't listen to our podcast.
Suck it, shrimp.
Those assholes.
You can see a million colors, but fuck you anyway.
And you're not going to hear us bad-mouthing you, so deal with it.
You never get to play Toe Jam and Earl.
They can't eat any chicken larb.
That's true. Oh, man. Josh and I had chicken larb before.
Hold that thought. He also put up a video about how he uses an iPhone. And went through all the accessibility, you know, he turned on like every accessibility option, and he actually seemed somewhat more efficient at using his iPhone while blind and using accessibility than I do not blind. I thought that was pretty
interesting.
Amazing. I mean, I don't know about Android phones, how they probably have similar accessibility.
This week turned on the accessibility. I am blind mode or whatever.
It's called?
On my phone. Yeah, whatever it's called.
It's called "You're a blind motherfucker, now turn this on" mode.
Because here's the deal.
They're really insensitive when they name that feature.
It's the Ray Charles mode, right?
In the Google Books app, you know, that I read with, there is a hidden option that will speak the book aloud to you.
Yeah.
And it doesn't show the option unless you're in the blind mode or the accessibility, whatever.
It doesn't show the option unless you're in blind mode.
The option is not
make available.
Yeah.
Right. So I went and, you know, turned it on, and then I had to relearn how to navigate through my whole phone. You have to like swipe up and down instead of actually touching on things.
Mm-hmm.
And you can touch on things, but then it just like reads anything that's under your finger. It's right. really weird. Mm-hmm. But that then, like, bringing up the notification bar or the settings or going to the next page, I didn't figure all that stuff out. So I was kind of locked out of my phone for a few hours until I had time to dig back in there and figure out how to turn it back off. Super. But when it read the book, that was super cool. It's really good voice.
You know who fought against that feature?
The book publishing industry.
The union of voice actors.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yeah. Putting them out of a job, huh?
Yeah. They're like, if anybody who has a Kindle or a... it was originally about Kindle or, you know... Google Play, whatever, can just have their phone read them their book, then we will no longer have jobs, which is short sighted. And I guess the way that they got around that objection, or the way that they were finally shamed into not pursuing this objection, was like, it's for accessibility, and maybe, you know, it's disabled unless they're in a special, you know, disability or accessibility mode.
And there's a huge draw to having one of your favorite voice actors
absolutely
read it, yeah, and they're gonna read it, it's better than a computer different. I mean, come on,
it's totally different.
Yeah It's kind of like a fear of the future thing, though. Although right now it's still much better to hear an actual actor read it than a computer. In theory they might be able to be matched someday. Yeah,
they're doing the NRA slippery slope thing, right, which is like, fuck no, you're not taking my guns, and you're also not taking my 50 caliber, you know, sniper rifle or my hollow point bullets, right, even though there's no reason I could possibly want that for hunting, yeah, right? Or my concealed carry permits or anything like that, right?
I mean, shouldn't everybody in any kind of entertainment industry have a little bit of the paranoia, or a little bit of paranoia about the future? Because, you know, seems like technology is moving closer and closer towards eliminating actors and music, because computers will eventually be able to create that. I mean, far-fetched in the future, but I mean, that's what it's moving towards, right?
But there will still need to be creative people managing those computers, right?
But once they've figured out a computer that can just write a new random song that everybody loves, then why would you make your own anymore?
They have, it's called Kesha?
Hi-oh!
I don't know.
I mean,
as much as everyone in the world should be paranoid about everything in the future.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a slippery slope, but it seems very short-sighted for them to be all like up in arms about something like that right now.
Right.
Yeah. Anything else random news going on? That's all I got for now.
Sure. Anybody? I got random.
Do it.
Have you guys seen Ong Bak?
Yes.
Ong Bak's pretty cool.
No,
Ong Bak is cool.
Okay. So Ong Bak is pretty cool.
I know
cool.
what it is, though. So
it's this Thai martial arts movie.
That's why I said I knew what it was.
That is the primary actor is Tony Jaa.
Yes.
And he is
Jaa.
I don't know how to say it right.
No, I was just agreeing with you by saying
Tony
Jaa.
That's him.
And he does like all his stunts without a stunt double, and they didn't use like any special effects or anything.
Yeah,
like,
it's pretty crazy.
Isn't Jackie Chan known for the same thing?
Yeah, there's some other people that are known for the same thing, okay. Yes, but this is a new movie, and it's not that new, but it's different, it's cool.
There's a scene where he runs across a crowd of people.
Yeah, that's pretty
by
rad.
Stepping on their shoulders.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that happened.
Impressive.
So, Ong Bak 2 and 3 have been made and are in Netflix streaming, so I watched those things, and wow, they are like a million times higher budget.
Uh-huh.
And Ong Bak 2 has like... unbelievably badass fight scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serious. Like the coolest I could imagine. Like the coolest I've ever seen. Maybe the coolest fight scenes of any movie I've ever seen.
Wow, really?
Go watch Ong Bak 2.
All right.
But as a movie, meh, you know, not so
sure,
great.
Yeah. None of like, those martial
wait,
arts
an awesome
movies.
Martial arts movie that's right. meh otherwise?
Right.
What?
Like, and as a movie, it's okay, yeah. right? But as like a sequence of ridiculous fight scenes,
A+.
It is A++. And then Ong Bak 3, actually like disappointing. Mm-hmm. Like they just couldn't, the plot just got completely
ridiculous.
Just like nothing is happening except
Ong Bak.
It's so dumb. And the fights are still cool, but not quite as cool. But Ong Bak 2, holy Jesus, everyone needs to watch that. If that sounds interesting to you, like cool kung fu. It's weapons, it's hand-to-hand,
yeah.
You know, all kinds of different weapons, improvised or traditional, you know, blades and bows and nunchucks and like all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Crazy. Cool. Super rad. As I said before, I'm reading Reamde. It's phenomenal. This is like Neal Stephenson's latest.
Yes.
Besides some other stuff. It's his latest full-length major novel, yeah. Polish, published by him. And
probably his most accessible since...
I think it's his most accessible.
Since Cryptonomicon.
Oh, successful? Is that what
most,
you said?
You think accessible?
Cryptonomicon is acceptable?
Accessible. Easy to get into.
Yeah. Cryptonomicon is like his.
I said most accessible, accessible since Cryptonomicon.
Yeah, but Cryptonomicon is not accessible at all.
But it's much more accessible than the Baroque Cycle, which is like incredibly esoteric and everybody.
His most accessible is Snow Crash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But I
didn't say most accessible.
Okay.
How come it's so hard to say that word?
The last episode was about not being able to pronounce things.
I said since Cryptonomicon.
Okay, anyway, this is
it's accessible.
His most, I think, accessible ever because it's a straightforward thriller that takes place in the present day.
Yeah.
Straightforward thriller, present day. It's just really well written
and happens to involve an MMO.
A bunch of super geeky shit. And there's, the backstory is there's an MMO with a really interesting economy. And then there's ransomware virus, and it goes from there. But it's so cool. I'm most of the way through it.
Agreed. I really like it, and I think that they should make it into an HBO. Like HBO should take 12 episodes and blow it out. It would be awesome.
Totally.
It'd be so awesome.
Totally. Man, it is the exact opposite of Anathem because Anathem made me hesitant to read everything else that he's written.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one just makes me want to read everything else.
Don't written. Read the Baroque Cycle. You won't like it.
Really?
I guarantee you won't like it.
I if heard
you
didn't it's like Cryptonomicon, Anathem. Though.
It involves some of the, like, theoretically some of the same characters, like their ancestors kind of thing. I liked it. Like, I mean, you should give it a shot. I don't want to discourage you from reading it, but if you found... here's
actually have the first one if you want to borrow it.
Did you find Anathem to be did you dislike it because it was slow or did you dislike it because it felt impenetrable?
There are two parts. It was both slow
and impenetrable.
It was both slow and there were just a shit ton of made up words.
Uh-huh.
And you know, his regular novels have a shit ton of words I don't know, but at least I can look up most of them, right? And especially in Google Books, like you press the word and you get to look at the definition of it. But his vocabulary is so out there that like a lot of his words aren't even in the Google Dictionary, even though they're English words.
And you can't get them from context?
To an extent, yeah. But,
I mean, did you read A Clockwork Orange? Because that's very similar. It's like a bunch of made-up words.
No. In Anathem, he makes up words. Well, in his regular books, like Reamde, he just uses like obscure English vocabulary, balderdash.
Right, but in A Clockwork Orange, there's a bunch of slang. Like they are made-up words. They're not real.
Yeah, a decent
amount.
But
you get it out of context.
Yeah, a decent amount of made-up words I'm cool with.
Yeah.
This is not even close to that. This is like totally obscure words.
Like invented language.
You cannot possibly know from context, and that he then explains the etymology of for like two pages. Like every chapter begins with the etymology of a word. I'm serious. Like there's just...
So it sounds like a linguist wet dream
kind
of book.
It is. It's like, oh man. That was combining with it being slow made it very difficult. So I could do one or the other, but not both simultaneously.
So if you disliked it because it was slow, then you will, but not because it was impenetrable, then you will probably be okay with Baroque Cycle because it's not as slow. It's not a particularly slow. But if you disliked it because it's like pretty complex and it's kind of annoying.
I love this complex stuff.
Yeah.
And I love when he talks about stuff in detail.
Then you might like it.
All right.
Give it a shot.
All right. Anyway, I started Dishonored. I can't form a full opinion on it yet.
How far in? Like, what
What like I got out of the jail. I got the 5 achievement points.
Okay. So you got through the first level. All right.
Yeah, my
what's your first impression
though? My first impression is it's one of the games where you have to look everywhere for coins. Yippee. Like
look everywhere for coins.
Yeah, it's one of those like Skyrim like not exactly, but like, you know, you're encouraged to scour every corner of every room of every level just to like pick up coins.
Well, encouraged and available. I don't think it's anywhere close to a Skyrim. I did not get that feeling at all.
I mean, it's not as close as a Skyrim.
I like picked up stuff as I saw it, but I did not feel the need to scour.
What do you use the coins for? Room.
Use it to buy stuff. Well, what do you think you use coins for? I mean,
what do you buy?
Well, I don't want to say because that would ruin the game for Josh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Their currency. Like tools? You use it to buy tools that make
I mean, things. You buy things, yeah. Dude. You buy useful things that help you play the game, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if it's magic and XP or if it's like items. Like, I haven't got there yet.
All right.
Yeah. But, and then the silent protagonist again is kind of not my thing.
Right.
Like, why doesn't he just fucking speak? Occasionally they, like, write a line of text that you read, and I guess that's what he said.
Yeah.
But why didn't they just give it a voice actor and give him more lines? Mm-hmm. Ugh.
Well, it's primarily a stealth game. I think it works with that he's not a big talker.
Yeah, we've had that discussion before. Yeah. But it's good. I mean, it's looks pretty cool.
Yeah,
cool. The it's smooth. I don't know.
You should beat that. So we can need more talk of an opinion.
Yeah. And I played a shit ton of DJ Max Technica Tune.
Is that the game that you were waiting like 5 years to come out and finally came out?
Yeah.
So it's out and you're loving it?
Yeah, it's good.
Okay.
Best thing on the Vita?
Best thing anywhere, ever?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the best thing ever. It's flawed, as usual, like every DJ Max game, but it's also like the best rhythm game, like every DJ Max game.
What if you could trade DJ Max for a cure for heart disease? Would you do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Wait, you're saying it's better than Rock Band as a rhythm game?
Yes, Rock Band has the primary flaw where when you press a note, like it almost has nothing to do. It just plays the pre-recorded like track. It continues to play the pre-recorded track.
It's less that you do something
is
that you stop it from not
doing
it.
Yeah, it's less that you did something and more that when you don't do something, it plays a stupid sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And DJ Max is the one that does what all the other rhythm games don't, which is when you press it, that's when the sound effect occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like it's more directly like you are creating the music. So as a musician or whatever, it's a subtle difference, but I think it really makes you feel more involved in actually making the music.
Mm.
And it changes, you know, exactly what instrument or whatever you're playing constantly. So, you know, you tap right now and it's a hi-hat, and then you tap a second later on the next bar and it's like a person singing. It's like a syllable.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally like push their syllables around if you do it in the wrong order. But if you do it at the right time, then it sounds like they sang the line perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it wrong, in an artistic way, you can almost make it sound like they're being scratched like a record. Like you're, you know, they're rapping at a weird rhythm. Which is kind of neat, and it's the best part is like learning the intended rhythms while getting them on like the wrong but what you predicted rhythms, but still sound okay.
I almost feel like the ideal rhythm game would take that concept, but put it in a Rock Band context.
Yeah, so Rock Band could be modified, but to some extent, this is also like a recording industry haggling type of agreement, like when they made Britney's Dance Beat. Right? You could not dance as Britney because she wouldn't sign a contract that let you dance as Britney because then you might be able to see Britney make a mistake on stage.
Uh-huh. Beatles Rock Band, you were not able to play solos, so they took out the whole solo mm-hmm. mechanic of Rock Band because the Beatles wouldn't allow the songs to be altered in any way.
Didn't they do some other weird stuff in Beatles?
Yeah, there were a number of
Like, I mean, they didn't do the
some stuff like
bad
that,
sound yeah. when you missed a note, or they did something.
Yeah, I think they got rid of that sound. Yeah, it was paramount that you did not alter the song in any way except for missing a note.
Because the artists are, like, super anal.
They are very super anal.
Yeah, well, this is all, like, K-pop.
Right.
And I guess the game had more power than the recording artists or something. I don't know.
Or they just don't care.
They think... I mean, it's in their... There's all kinds of rhythm games in Korea that they're all a big fan of, and I don't know.
It's a very different mindset.
They trust them more, I guess. There's more of a collaborative effort.
When you think about the Beatles, you know, they're probably not, like, the most forward-thinking technology people, so making a game out of their music was probably very scary.
And it's important to the Beatles to preserve a legacy.
Yeah. But it's just sad that they can't see that the legacy can be preserved while augmenting the gameplay at the same time.
Yeah, it's not going to ruin their reputation.
Right. Their reputation is done. Like, nothing can really be done to the Beatles at this point, you know.
Yeah. So the touch interface is more immediately intuitive. So, you know, like your mom was saying, like, it's just touch the thing on the screen when the line hits it. So it's a lot easier.
So it's not using any of the buttons?
None. Wow. 100% front and back screen.
Why isn't this a touchscreen game? Like, why isn't it on iOS and...
Here's the reason. It's $45 or $50.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just wooden stuff.
They easily could have made it for iPad or Android. And I think they intentionally decided not to because they didn't think they'd have a market there where people would pay that much. They'd get ripped in the media, and everyone would say, why isn't this game $10?
Right.
And it would get negative press and not enough sales. Or they'd have to be forced to do like a free-to-play model where it's like zero, but you unlock songs for a couple dollars each or whatever, which they could do, which is an option, and they might do like in the sequel or the next one they make.
Or it would cannibalize sales of the $50 Vita version if they did the $10.
Yeah. So they'll do something different, like DJ Max Ray or Cytus or whatever. You know, they have a history of doing a free to play type of model on the PC. Mm-hmm. And so they can have like slightly different editions with different models. So I expect them to make an iPad or something soon, but it's not announced. But yeah, this game is $50, and it's totally worth it because there's 67 songs and 3.4 or whatever difficulty levels. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I mean, there's not much to it except there's a bunch of songs at difficulty levels. And there's a weird gaming mechanic where you have to do three in a set to get a high score, and then there's this mode where you do three, and then they give you a fourth randomly, and you have to do those all in a row and to unlock them. It's kind of arbitrary. They're just good songs, and they're fun to tap to. And the K-pop genre variety is diverse from like symphonic trance to like girl band Kara, like, you know, like a boy band or whatever, like Kesha or something, a Korean Kesha, to like jazzy or rock. There's rock, there's like hip hop, there's R&B, there's pretty much every genre but Korean pop version of that genre. And it's really engaging because like Psy or whatever, like the Korean pop version of all these genres, like, has so many layers and you know, I wouldn't...
It's like, it's a producer. It's not almost not about the artist. It's about the producer.
Yeah, it's about maximum production.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't necessarily listen to this music all the time on my own on a CD or something, but... I really like, it's like perfect for this kind of game because there's so many different like syncopated rhythms and melodies like just layered on top of each other. It's like, it's ADD music, man. Like every measure, like a new instrument comes in. Like there's freaking saxophone everywhere. There's like, you know, there's just instruments that we don't get because they're not cool here.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that you'd never hear in pop here.
Sax is coming back.
There's just like instruments constantly all over the place.
It's perfect for a video game because
it is.
You can have, you know, you have an intense variety, especially if it's kind of like straight ahead, you know, four on the floor dance beat music, that could get pretty boring if you're just typing out the same thing over and over. But if there's, you know, 40 different tracks and you can, you know, as you say, now I'm playing the vocal track, now I'm tapping to, you know, percussion, now I'm tapping to the saxophone. It, you know, it lends itself to the gameplay.
Yeah, like Rock, well. Rock Band Blitz kind of tries to do that concept, but they don't do it well at all. It's just not fun. And Rock Band itself is obviously fun, but it's like totally dedicated to being true to the music. So you are playing the guitar notes one-to-one for the whole song if you're playing guitar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is cool if the song is like perfectly made for a video game, but most of them aren't. Most of them have like really repetitive choruses that you have to do the same riff like a billion times or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you have like a whole gap where you're not doing anything and you're waiting for the other instruments. And like every fucking song in DJ Max is custom built for DJ Max. Like you can tell you do all the instruments, you rotate whenever the game designers want you to rotate because it, you know, it'd be boring if you're on the same instrument. Super cool.
Well, and it's built for a single player to be able to do all that, whereas Rock Band is was built for multiple players, like by design.
Yeah.
It's not really best with one person.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure how you could improve Rock Band keeping its obligations there.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a rock star simulator. It's more that than it is a hyper-focused rhythm game.
Yeah, this is like a kind of different genre.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit subgenre.
Yeah.
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 So, yeah, you guys got to play it. I got to lend this shit to you.
All right. Sounds good. Anything else going on with you? Nope. Chaz, bump it over to you.
I want to give a shout out to the iOS Gmail app, which is great.
Really shout it out.
Great. So good. The first version. So there was a version that was in the App Store for like 8 hours and was immediately pulled. It was apparently horrible.
How long ago was that?
This year, 6 months,
okay.
Something like that. Then there was a relatively recent version, which I started using because it had a couple key features, but wasn't that good. Kind of glorified mobile app. Like it was almost better just to go to the gmail.com webpage using a mobile browser than use it. But it had a couple things that were good, particularly that it supported the Gmail feature of sending as someone, which iOS mail does not, for whatever reason. I don't get it, but you can't send as multiple accounts, right? Or you can, I guess you can
send as like a Gmail account and like an iCloud account,
corporate,
but you can't have you can't have multiple Gmail accounts, right, I think, and send as all of them in one
so
shot.
Anyway, the version supported that feature, which is excellent and key for my email use. So I was psyched about that. The most recent update is primarily a visual one, and it looks amazing. Google is, I think, in a better position than Apple right now, because I think Google is getting better at design faster than Apple is getting better at services, like web services, right? And it's, I guess, either it's just easier or they have better HR or whatever. They started with this super hardcore engineering background and then have brought in designers and creatives to make it beautiful and pretty and very functional and, you know, good information architecture and user experience. And Apple kind of went the other way. They always had these beautiful, creative, big thinking ideas, but they haven't necessarily. All their kind of service initiatives have kind of flopped, like Ping, the social music service, didn't really work. Literally didn't work. That was an abject failure. The MobileMe is kind of semi-successful and has a little bit of uptake, but not really.
Well, and it's iCloud now, so.
Yeah, and yeah, so, it's, but the, like iWork, nobody really uses that either. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just, it's harder to do the services stuff than it is to do the creative stuff. It's harder to layer that stuff in if it's what you're missing, I think. Hmm. Anyway, this new Gmail app looks beautiful. Even the super simple, how everybody has like the little thing that circles in the middle to tell you that you're waiting for something, right? It's a round thing and it goes around in a circle. That's just how that thing is supposed to look. It doesn't look like that, but it's so pretty. It's a circle, But instead of being something that swirls around itself in a clockwise fashion, it folds over itself. So it's like a red circle, and then half of it folds over and half of it's blue. And then up from the bottom, up folds like a lavender half circle. And it just keeps doing this folding animation that accomplishes the same effect completely as telling you, okay, I'm just going up to the cloud to pull some information down. Hang on. But it's just such a better... I mean, it's just prettier. It's just...
Does it make you think subconsciously that it's working better if it looks better?
I appreciate it for looking better. I appreciate that somebody spent time on making it look better.
When do you see that? Like, in the Gmail app? If I'm in the Gmail app on Android and I want to attempt to see the equivalent,
so like when you refresh to see if you have new mail?
Bounce to, you know, drag down so that you refresh to see new mail. Yeah, the Gmail app on tablet doesn't do it. They have the same little circling thing.
Yeah, got a circle.
Yeah. I'll show you. It looks great. And it looks better.
You can't drag down.
It literally looks better than the Gmail app, the native Gmail app on my Nexus 7, even though it doesn't function as well because there's less screen real estate, right? So
weird.
It's not as good functionally, but the design is great. I mean, just really, really great. Anyway, that's cool. I thought about mentioning this last week, or I actually had it in here, but I missed it. This... don't know what this person does. Her name is Sophie Holden. This is the CanArt Be Games thing. I'm not sure if she's a blogger or what her actual occupation is, but this person called Sophie Holden wrote a blog entry column, kind of a humorous take on this issue that we as gamers have discussed for a long time, which is, are games art? Can games be art? There have been a number of, you know, kind of more and less famous entrance into this larger debate. Roger Ebert at one point wrote that games couldn't be art and got a bunch of flack from the internet at large about that. This person, Sophie Holden, took a kind of a humorous approach to the whole thing. And so she wrote an article called Can Art Be Games? Which is written, you know, in a kind of a pitch-perfect imitation of the same article that you see written all the time, which is, you know, someone at the New Yorker decided to try this video games thing that their kid is always doing. And so they always write the same article it's just ridiculous. So anyway, I'm just going to read a paragraph here. I had always assumed that art, in quotes, was something for a different generation. So to get a better understanding, I ordered an art from the internet to give it a go. What I got was a framed print, in quotes, of a painting. What that means is that it's not actually the source painting, but a copy of it, much like how the games you play rarely contain their source code. I'm told that there are many types of art, but this is by far the most popular. So it's just really funny. We'll link to it in the show notes. Definitely worth
it. It is brilliant.
Yeah.
I like it.
It is brilliant. And she's not just like making fun of those articles. She's writing it in a way that it's making a legitimate case for games being superior to traditional art methods in a lot of ways.
Or at least as worthy of respect. You know, she's using the humor of the juxtaposition to say, this really isn't that much of a juxtaposition. Like, just think about it for a second. There are real advantages to doing storytelling this way.
Right, right. I mean, the end result is that she would say at least as respectable.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it's written... it's in such a way that it's showing no respect to art, to paintings and such,
mm-hmm.
right? And like they are
total lack of interactivity.
Yeah,
you know,
lack all these qualities that games, you know, have that are awesome.
Yeah, no expressivity.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, to an extent, her point is even stronger than her ironic humor to some folks, because there are a ton of people that you know would agree with it legitimately. Like I personally, you know, I'm a fan of visual arts, but I have rarely been emotionally moved by a static image,
mm-hmm.
right? By any type of painting, sculpture, etc. Right, anything that's not moving, I've rarely been emotionally moved by that, you know, even close to like a bad movie or a bad video game. You know what I mean?
I do.
I agree.
I mean, there are sculptures. There's one in particular that I'm thinking about that are like endlessly fascinating and make me think. But as you say, emotionally moved, it's pretty rare.
Yeah.
Yeah. A film, TV, right? Very emotionally moving and can manipulate the shit out of you. And there are companies like, you know, Disney and Pixar are total masters at manipulating emotion, right? But yeah, a painting or a piece of sculpture, I don't know.
Yeah, and you know, and I mean, it may just actually just have to do with our age and what we grew up with. We grew up with video games probably from a young age, and they have had a much bigger impact in general on our generation than, you know, a lot of the generations before us, who are often making the statement that games can't be art, because that's not what they grew up with. Mm-hmm. They grew up with, you know, visual art and movies and paintings and sculpture being kind of the primary art that you interacted with. Whereas I think our generation, video games are a large slice of the art that we interact with. And so we're coming at it from a completely different, like, foundation.
Yeah.
You know, so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that movie that I said, hey, have you guys seen, oh wait, no, I don't remember the name of it.
Yes.
I'm going to wait until I can look it up.
All right,
I said that last week. Okay, so that movie is, I actually recommend it. It's weird.
What is it called?
So it is called Jade Soturi, one word, which means Jade Warrior in Finnish. So Jadesoturi. So you guys aware of this epic poem called the Kalevala? Have you heard of that? Maybe just...
No.
So it's kind of like the Beowulf of Finland, or, you know, it's like an
Odyssey
epic...
or something like that.
Yeah, it's like an epic poem that's kind of the foundation of their history. It's like, you know, 10,000 lines and was handed down through this oral tradition from, you know, way back.
The ancient Finns.
This is a movie that posits that ancient Finland had contact with ancient China, and it is set both in the present day Finland and in ancient China. And
that seems impossible.
Also, like, it's set like across, you know, it's a kung fu movie in the vein of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, that kind of like wushu school of kung fu. Like wire work and jumping around and kung fu fights, but the lead actor is a Finnish guy, because apparently there was, and it's like it posits that the Kalevala and ancient Chinese dynastic action were the same thing, and that there were like all these overlappings and crossovers, and it's just this really weird and so, but the Kalevala is full of like these, you know, a lot of interactions with gods and demigods, you know, kind of in the same way that Pan or the Greek gods would come have, you know, Daphne would come and interact with actual humans, and they would play around and meddle in their affairs. There's a lot of that happening with these, like, Finnish, you know, Norse gods. And so those guys are intermingled with the kind of Chinese gods, and it's fun and weird and has, you know, sweet kung fu and fun. There's a kung fu fight where one of these demigods fights a dude with a stick. He's got like a stick with, which is like, he's got like a bunch of herbs, and he's using that as the weapon that he's fighting a guy with. It's pretty cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
I was thinking about achievement. This might be like mini topic, about achievement and whether or not achievement makes sense in games, like achievement points and levels and scores.
Gamer score, trophies.
Yeah. So I was buying something at a store, and you know, I played with a debit card that was from my bank, and the guy said, "Oh, you've been a member." Oh, and my debit card says like member for, you know, 25 years or something on my, it must say like member for 20 years, something like that. on my debit card. And he's like, oh, he happens to be the person who is at the cash register said, oh, you've been a member for longer than I have. I only have 15 years on there or something like that. And I was like, we were talking about it, and I felt this weird and bizarre sense of pride that I had been a member of this bank for mm-hmm. longer.
Yeah, like having a low ICQ number.
Right, and like, that doesn't mean anything. It's so meaningless. And when I had that thought, then I also thought about how, like, every time I go to work, I work in a building with 15 floors, and so when I get on the elevator and I hit 12, whenever everybody on the elevator with me is lower than me, I feel this weird sense of accomplishment. I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm going to floor 12, and you douches are all getting off on lower floors. I'm so much better than you, right?
That one's a little harder for me to identify with, but I kind of get what you're saying, yeah.
I'm saying it's completely irrational, but I still experience this, like, all right, and then somebody will, like, get on and push 14, and I'm like, oh, shit, I suck. I suck compared to that guy. He's so much better than I am, you know? It doesn't mean anything.
You
and
often have this dialogue or monologue in your head? Or just very occasionally?
I notice it every time now.
I work in a one-story building, so I can't have this this inner monologue.
Yeah, I notice it. I notice that sense. Like,
your head hit the guitar. That counts.
Yes. Okay. We'll count that as a headbutt. Guitar headbutt. Yeah. So I don't know.
That seems totally normal. That doesn't seem weird. I don't know. We all think in terms of that.
I think it's weird in that it's something. It's these sort of meaningless symbols, and I feel that way about GamerScore. But I also feel irrationally good when, you know, somebody mentions their gamer score and it's less than mine. So, like, what is that?
Yeah, I can't be sure about this, but I feel like this is, like, not that it's, like, a mental disorder, but it's totally this higher functioning, like, when all your needs are met constantly and you don't fear that a saber-toothed tiger is going to kill you, you don't fear where your food is going to be, you don't fear having a roof over your head. You know, your mind starts wandering and comes up with these kinds of things, you know, these little mental tricks and games that it plays. And, you know, it's like you're trying to create competition where there is no competition because you don't really compete with anybody in any real sense of the word. Not like Ancient Man, who was literally competing for resources constantly.
Right.
You know, we don't really do that. We live in civilized society. We're not fighting for anything really most of the time. And so, but you still like the feeling of superiority. So you invent these dumb little reasons to feel superior that, I don't know. It seems perfectly natural. No big deal. I don't know, what do you think, Josh?
They are, I mean, I don't know exactly where you want to go with the conversation because it's, are you talking about like the nature of competition, right? Like, why do we even feel motivated to feel better than anyone ever? Right? Because like scores and badges, you know, et cetera, are just ways of putting a label on and quantifying like achievements or accomplishments or.
But some scores are like if you score
just
higher
things
than
that you've done.
If you score higher than me at Tetris, then that's like a one-to-one comparison that actually means something. But if you're getting off on a lower floor because your company happens to have the floor below mine, like...
So the floor one,
with my brain that I'm like, oh yeah, I feel cool about that.
The floor one is too weird, I don't know.
Yeah,
I can't relate to that one. But the 20-year account thing, that one kind of makes sense because it like shows commitment, it shows like... a long period of
loyalty.
Time. Like, yeah, it represents.
So the guy goes, so you must have been a First Future member when they acquired First Future. I was like, no, motherfucker. I was there when it was San Diego Teachers Credit Union like 25 years ago. Like, and I'm like, wait a minute, why do I feel good about that? That doesn't mean anything. That's so dumb.
Now, did that guy
That is a hipster thing. That is like me first.
Maybe it's I was at this credit union before they were cool.
Did he do anything prior to this conversation that made you kind of dislike him and
no,
need
nothing
to feel
at all.
Superior?
Nothing whatsoever. And it's not like I was feeling it's not like I held it over him or gloated or in any sense.
It was just a thought really quick. It was just like, why did I think that?
Oh, sweet. I've been there longer.
It's purely like a hipster thing. Like I saw a movie before you did, so I feel awesomer because it's a great movie and you haven't experienced that yet. And it's, you know, it's relevant to the XKCD comic that that says, the gist is whenever you encounter someone that hasn't experienced something awesome. Right. It's like the lucky. Yeah. Whenever you encounter someone that hasn't experienced something awesome that you have, like the proper, method of behavior is not to gloat. It's to like be really excited for them.
Yeah.
That they are about to experience it for the first time.
Yeah. You're one of today's lucky 10,000.
Yeah. Lucky 10,000 that get to experience that for the first time.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily that people gloat, but that they some do. Often the response is like, "Really? Oh my God, you haven't seen the thing that you just told me you hadn't seen?" You know, it's like, "Oh my God, you didn't know about this band, or you haven't seen that movie? Everybody's seen that movie." You know?
Yeah, but the hidden feeling behind that, like
is
your
a
elevator,
sense of superiority,
is the sense of superiority.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, doesn't really make sense. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we'd have to tie that to some kind of like biological.
I think it's just a general sense of insecurity, especially, I mean, I'll just be honest. Like, I think you guys experience way more new stuff than me. And so I live in a constant state of like, there's no way I will ever see more new things than you because I just don't consume media in the same way.
Well, you spend more time creating music. And...
Yeah, but. But you guys aren't as interested in that as I am.
You can browse through more.
So there's no superiority to feel there.
you can scroll through and scrim more headings in Reddit faster than I can.
Yeah, but no, that just makes me feel sad and depressed.
And Charles is, you know, raising a child more than we are.
Whatever. That doesn't count.
That's a lot of hours, right? Like, I get to watch more dumb kung fu movies. Charles gets to create a being.
Yeah, but I can understand the feeling where if I have seen something, not only have I seen or experienced something that you guys haven't, but that you want and are a tiniest bit jealous that you have not yet experienced it, that feeling is juicy as hell. I almost never feel that way about anything.
Did you watch Tucker and Dale versus Evil, motherfuckers?
No, I've still watched almost nothing.
Still on the list, but I fully intend to.
That feeling of superiority reigns this week, but eventually
no,
it will fall.
I want you to watch it. I want you to be the 10,000 today or whatever. Two quick more news items that I just found interesting. I just want to mention real fast.
You can basically talk about anything. We're not
we're not doing anything.
Yeah.
Kindle did this thing recently where they have like an extra login on their tablets for your kids.
Yes.
And it's like a whole kids zone.
Oh, yes, that's really
kids
awesome.
Subscription,
yeah,
and account so that like all the apps are completely segregated and
it's curated kid
and
content.
It's curated and it's nice like infinite for free. Like instead of buying it, you know, worrying about your kids buying too many apps or whatever, you just pay a $5 subscription or something like that, mm-hmm. and then they can install like all these apps there for
and it's
free.
Apps and video. And
books
and
stuff.
And video and everything.
Books, yeah.
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 That is awesome.
That sounds super brilliant. Man, that's one of these things that, you know, even though I'd like to say the Kindle Fires are inferior in a lot of ways, like they're doing things that are smarter. Everybody's got their own advantages.
Yep.
Yeah. And
Amazon's really the only company that can stand up to Apple as far as the ecosystem goes. The content ecosystem.
I don't know what you mean by that. I mean
books and video.
Like Google Books has a shit ton of books.
Yeah.
But is it really lacking a lot of new releases or something?
I mean, I don't know. But as far as I understand it, Amazon is considered to be the equivalent to Apple's iTunes infrastructure and Google Books. Yeah, I think they probably are. Like, I bet if we went, they're lacking this publisher relationship and that small one. And it's never any of the super mainstream stuff. It's all these edge cases. And iTunes has the broadest amount of music available. And, I mean, they compete on that stuff. You know, if you go look at the iTunes stats, they say, we have X number of million songs in the database, and Amazon has slightly less than that, and Google Play has slightly less than that, you know?
I don't know, man, because you can get all the Amazon MP3s on Android or iOS,
mm-hmm.
right? I assume.
I believe so. Yeah.
You know, you can get all the Kindle books on Android. You know,
yeah, that's what, like, that's one of their advantages. That's like, what
but,
I'm saying.
But I mean, when they review the tablets and say like the infrastructure is insufficient here or mm-hmm. not as good, it like that's not how you can't rate the tablet on that because it still has access to the other infrastructure. I don't know. Never mind. Ken Levine had a comment about, let's see, it was the
Bioshock Infinite cover art.
Did you see this?
I did not see the cover art.
Oh, you gotta see
people
it.
People are okay. blowing up.
Like, just Google.
Hugely negative about this. Like, oh, it's my God. Very controversial.
Well, I saw it a few days ago and I was like, lol, dumb cover art for a good game.
I don't know. I didn't, yeah, I reacted neutral. I was like, all right. Yep, that's the cover.
It's a. Have you seen any of the info about BioShock
Infinite?
Well,
shut
Infinite
up while
yet?
I want look at it. Don't spoil it.
Previous
if it's dumb
to
or not.
This, what did you know about BioShock Infinite?
I read like there was a major like 12-page spread in Game Informer. I read articles about it. I probably watched like a gameplay video or
I've seen a fair
a trailer.
Amount.
And did you even like know about?
Is it the one with the guy?
Yeah
the with dude the with the shotgun.
Yeah.
Why is that dumb?
Yeah, I don't understand what the big hoopla. It's I don't know. Maybe it's not the best cover in the world, but it's not worth like 20 articles written about it.
It's like the opposite of what I expected. Because
what did you expect?
The game doesn't seem like a shooter, like
what?
A shotgun shooting.
It's totally a well.
It's BioShock.
It's an FPS.
It's nothing but a shooter.
I don't know. Like everything.
Did you want like the Big Daddy equivalent cover? Like
everything they've
not
been
the main
like
hero
focusing
guy?
On or promoting in the coverage of it so far
mm-hmm.
has been like story based and like climbing on those things in the sky and like characters and
like the weird force powers
environments
they have,
and weird powers
causing a guy to explode into bees
and
whatever
weird stuff like that, right? And I don't know. The cover art is just a dude with a shotgun, and
that's the dude, and he has a shotgun.
I'm not saying it's the worst thing in the world.
Yeah,
I don't think it's even surprising in the extent that like it makes sense why they would do that.
You should read what he wrote.
But it was surprising in the sense that like it is not at all what I had in my head for the game. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't have. So I think I might be the guy here who likes BioShock the least among the three of us, and I really felt it was pretty generic as far as gameplay mechanics go. I know they're trying to do a bunch of crazy stuff. I never really got that from the game. I think it's one of the games where I feel like, you know, the sense of place and the story was a lot better than the mechanics. You know, so in that sense, it's doing it right. But the gameplay itself never really struck me as anything that innovative or special. I just always felt like a super generic shooter as far as the actual gameplay systems went. And I, you know, a guy with a shotgun totally seems to sum up, you know, what I'm expecting from BioShock Infinite.
Did you play through the first one?
I played 3/4 of it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's I don't know. Yeah, I pretty much disagree. I thought it was a brilliant game. And I played it way after it was popular. I played it when it came out on Xbox, like, you know, full game download mm-hmm. for like $20. And I was blown away. I was like engaged the whole time. And I thought the story was really cool. I thought the gameplay was cool.
I did too.
Cool.
I thought the
environment was cool.
The environment
was cool. The visuals were cool.
Environment's the best thing about it. Yeah. The story and the, you know, kind of story twist at the end is the second best thing about it. I feel like the gameplay systems, the actual combat, is distant fourth or fifth or whatever. Personally.
Hmm. Okay.
The gameplay system, I thought, was not... I mean, I don't know. Even if you didn't like it, which, you know, is fine, I don't see how you thought it was, like, a really typical shooter. I mean, you're put in all these environments where you have a lot of options. I mean, it's more like, it's almost like a stealth.
Yeah, it's kind of more Dishonored
like
than
Deus Ex or Dishonored.
Than
where
Doom
you, where
or
you
whatever.
Have a lot of options of how to approach any given situation.
So let me say...
You can try to distract dudes by hacking bots and like, you know, sending bees to things and getting other people on your side. And like, there's a lot of
weird
ways to approach any mechanic instead of just running and gunning.
I will backtrack a little bit and say it's as typical a shooter as I ever play. Because I don't ever fucking play Call of Duty, right?
Well, neither do I.
I never play that stuff. So it's as generic an FPS as I really play. So, you know, okay. I have a skewed perspective as far as that goes. So I will definitely cop to that.
Yeah, let's move on.
That's it.
That's it.
All right. So as far as TV movies, All I've done for the past few days is plow through Parks and Rec season 4.
Nice.
Love that show. Oh god, like every moment I have free, I'm just watching episodes, and there's too many of them. It's taking too long. I want to finish it. I want to say that I'm done, so I can then say, yeah, that was sweet. But I'm almost there.
So that you can then watch more of it once it starts up again.
Well, it is on right now on TV, but I can't watch season 5 until I've caught up. So yes, exactly. I also watched that show. I watched a couple episodes of that show you mentioned a few podcasts ago, Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Mm-hmm. I watched the Michael Richards episode and the Alec Baldwin episode. It's a better show than I thought. I mean, I thought it would be funny, but it's actually funny and insightful, you know, and short, so it never outstays its welcome. And since you're a car guy, the first 2 minutes of any episode are probably
kind of fun, yeah.
Way more interesting to you than... They're just generally interesting to me, but...
Two highlights. The Ricky Gervais episode, very good. And the Joel Hodgson episode, who is the host of MST3K. Good ones.
Nice. And then that actually led me to a related video. I think I watched this before when it was originally on, but I couldn't remember, so I just watched it again. It was in four parts, and it was called Talking Funny, I think, and it was like a round table with Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Ricky Gervais, and Louis C.K.
Where did you see it?
It was on YouTube.
No kidding.
It was just four parts on YouTube, like really like 240p or 360p. I mean, it was not.
So somebody just uploaded it, but they haven't taken it down yet?
I guess so. I don't know how old it is. How old is that?
I mean, it's within the year. I don't think it's more than like 2 years old, but it was it was on HBO originally.
Okay,
so,
It was all on YouTube, and it was really good. It was an interesting roundtable of some of the top comedians right now talking about comedy. What was weird is that Chris Rock like barely spoke. I would say he spoke like 5% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think, you know, maybe he's not the funniest of the four there, but I think he has a unique voice, and I was kind of disappointed that he didn't really give more insight. He was almost barely there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, he felt kind of wasted, like he could have just not been there.
Live event, he might have had an off day, just like Obama's first debate or whatever.
Yeah, it was kind of Obama's first
he might
debate.
Also he be done. The most reserved of those,
which is so weird because his stand-up is so kind of like almost outlandish.
His stage persona is very outsized, but maybe he's a more reserved individual just in a more normal setting.
Yeah, I don't know.
I agree. That is quite good. That's
interesting. And they all have very different voices and opinions about things, but they're also just all funny in different ways. So
have you seen Jerry Seinfeld's documentary called Comedian?
I have not.
If you like that, you should check that out for sure. It's about him doing a huge stand-up, like TV stand-up special, wherein he delivers an hour of comedy that he's been working on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't do that set anymore. So it's about him developing a completely new hour of hour-long comedy special, like then the process of being a stand-up and writing stand-up comedy jokes, and has a lot of that same kind of thinking and talking with other comedians about comedy and the process of comedy.
Cool. So some music news. Austin Wintory, he wrote the soundtrack for Journey, which is fucking amazing, the game and the soundtrack. It was actually nominated for a Grammy, and it's the first score from a video game ever nominated for a Grammy.
Yeah,
The first song was actually Baba Yetu from Civilization 4. I don't know whether that won, but it was at least nominated. So that's awesome. I mean, that's, you know, another step in the legitimization of video game music. So sweet for him. In more sad news, the Blip Festival ended. So the Blip Festival started in 2005 in New York City by the artist Bitshifter. It's basically kind of the chiptune scene. It's about, it's a festival for chiptune artists and people related to that or who use chiptune aesthetics in their music, and it was sort of like, you know, the Coachella for chiptune, but much smaller and, you know, not at a huge, you know, 50,000 person outdoor stadium kind of thing, more like in an underground club kind of a way.
Right.
But it's been going on since 2005, and apparently this year in October in Tokyo, they did the very last show, which sounds sad because that's definitely something I would have loved to go to, but I never got a chance to. But it also kind of means maybe that the chiptune as a scene, as like an outside thing that not a lot of people know about, has become more popular. Like a lot of popular artists now, you know, that are on, you know, record labels, like use lo-fi sounds in their music.
Yeah,
and it's
absolutely.
Almost like not really like a weird thing anymore. It like is normal. It's just another aesthetic, you know, just like a guitar or drums. So this ending almost kind of feels like it signifies that, you know, they're no longer outsiders. They're actually, which could be both good and bad, depending on how you see underground scenes. You know, maybe you don't want it to be, you know, like it's like autotune when it first came out was a really interesting tool for artists. But now it's kind of been like beaten to death like a dead horse. And a lot of people think it's a bad thing.
So autotune as a studio technique existed for like 20 years.
Right.
Before it ever started getting used. But in the original, I heard an interview with the guy who invented the technique, and he was like, you know, not appalled, but shocked and, you know, taken aback when people started using it such that it could be heard, mm-hmm. right? It like was always intended to, you know, bring up, you know, someone's, you know, someone was, you know, sang a note in the studio flat by, you know, like a semiquaver, and they wanted to bring it up just that tiny bit so that it's exactly on pitch. And, you know, it was a studio production tool, not, and this, I mean, the use of it in a way that it can be listened to and heard and identified as quote autotune has been, you know, was, it was never intended to be something that could be heard or even listen to, or you'd be aware you were listening to.
It sort of seems a bit like record scratching. Like that was more, you know, no, that was never meant to be an aesthetic, but people started using it as one, and now it seems totally normal to use that. You know, or glitch music. You know, the sounding of things going wrong is now an aesthetic, and not just, you know, failure to be good at music. So, one album that I just listened to recently is by an artist called Le Grudge and Rugged, which is actually two artists. One of them is Disaster Piece, and the other one is Dirk Rugged. They trade off tracks on this soundtrack for this game called Crunch, which comes out in about a week. From their website, it is, quote, a quick reflex game about escaping, survival, and the fear of being closed in. Grown from a Ludum Dare prototype, one of those game jams, Crunch draws inspiration from NES-era gaming and has an exclusive, and this is the interesting part that you might find cool, two-player mode for the Winatron 1000, the indie video game cabinet. So I was like, what the hell is the Winatron 1000? That sounds interesting. So I went to the website. Quote, the Winatron 1000 is a free-to-play independent video game arcade cabinet featuring new games created by indie game developers from Winnipeg and across the globe. The idea for the Winatron 1000 came out of the first Winnipeg game jam and was forged from a refurbished 80s arcade cabinet named Total Carnage. So it sounds kind of like an indie MAME that can also update itself and talk to other game cabinets over the internet. So there's currently four of them. Three of them are in Canada, and one of them is in New York. And there's information on their website where you can build your own indie game arcade cabinet that can update itself and talk to other game cabinets to share, like, pictures and high scores.
That sounds rad.
And this game that they're building is going to be on there and have some exclusive two-player mode.
Damn, dude.
So it is someone needs to make one of those
thing before
in San Diego, and I want to play that shit.
I want to make... Sweet. Man, I hope that they... I feel like they should just do, like, a client for an Android tablet and just use one of those little tablet arcade machines. Because those are super cool. You've seen, like, the little, like, iPad-sized arcade machine. It has a joystick and it has the buttons, but you just slot an iPad into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They should totally.
And I mean, that sounds cool, but that probably is not their aesthetic. Their aesthetic is, like, remember arcades and how awesome those cabinets were? We want to do that again, except let's make new indie games for it rather than let's take what is new technology and slap on old control mechanisms. Like, you know, they want you to go to an arcade and play a stand-up cabinet that has indie games in it. They don't necessarily want you to take your
iPad.
It's
not gonna be at an arcade, right? You're gonna build this
no,
in your, it
is. No, no, no. This is like room, this, right? This is not something you build in your house. This is something it's that not? Like an arcade would build that you could come and
there are, okay so that's never to gonna get it. Built in San Diego. I thought the whole point was that it's like a maker thing and you just make it if you want one.
I don't think it's for a single person to build in your house. It's something that you put out someplace that other people can come
there
play.
There are four of these, like, in public places, full-size arcade cabinets. Mm-hmm. And they're, like, art installations to an extent. Or they're just, like, arcades in bars, except they're free. And, like, if you wanted to put one up in San Diego somewhere, like, you might be able to contact him and download the shit and build one and put it up. But
it's not, like, just a freely available build one if you want to type thing.
I don't know.
I don't know if it's freely available.
Like Creative Commons.
I didn't look into how you actually make one of these.
That sounds more bullshit than I thought.
Well, I think it's just because you're coming at it from a different viewpoint. It's not a hobby project for anybody to make. It is more of a, you know, arcades were awesome. Let's bring back arcades, and here is a way that we have figured out how to do something like that.
I'm much more interested in it if it's something that they want a million people to do and to create like a whole network of these machines that are all over the place.
Well,
rather than like one per city.
Maybe. Well, but that's the thing is that I don't think these things are that easy to make. You know, it's probably going to start this way, and if this kind of shit would take off, then maybe that would be the future. But right now, that's too much to like.
You need like an arcade cabinet, and you need a mini PC, right? Like,
but most people don't have room or the know-how to make their own arcade cabinet.
So, you don't make it, you buy one. You can buy an arcade cabinet with a working TV and joysticks and buttons for like $100. You can go buy a Total Carnage machine.
Okay, maybe there's more to this and you can read up on it, but that's what I got out of it. So
your an emotional response I share in the sense that when I first heard about the Winnetron, I was like, this sounds rad. And I went to their site and I was like, this is rad. Where can I play one? And I was like, there's one in Winnipeg. Like, fuck this shit. Done. Right now there's four and that's cool. It'd be nice if there are more, but it sounds like they're either not ambitious enough or creative enough to share everything in a way that's gonna make them go viral.
Like, are they trying to make money on it, or are they trying to like be douchey artists about
No, I mean, I think it. I mean, that's what it's.
Or do they want
it's
to
a free to play
cool.
independent video game arcade cabinet. So I don't think they're trying to make money off this. This is a. Huh. This is a for the good of. This is a public utility. This
find
is not,
out, Chaz, if we can build one.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't need Winnetron 1000 to make your own game cabinet. Obviously, you already know you can do that.
We want their software.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I want their software. I'm way more interested in something like that, building a cabinet for something like this, than building a MAME cabinet. But
I don't know. Those both seem interesting. The thing about this is that this would not have the legality issues of building a MAME cabinet.
Precisely.
Right.
Precisely.
Right. But this is also, this probably has like five games, whereas a MAME cabinet has every arcade game ever made.
But I was envisioning that like you could use it for any indie game, right? Like it's not going to be limited to whatever.
Yeah, that I don't know. Yeah. Obviously, you're more interested in this than I was in the 5 minutes that I read up on it. So you should go look up more about this. We'll put it in the show notes. Games. I played some games. Dark Souls 2 was announced. Josh would be interested in that.
We don't talk about announcements a lot. I mean, yeah.
I mean, well, I didn't know they were doing a sequel to it. I mean, it's not like Diablo Souls, you know? It's literally Dark Souls 2. Like, they're making a sequel to an existing property rather than a new that's interesting.
Yeah.
You love that game. It's like your favorite game of all time.
Yeah.
You should be ecstatic right now.
I'm ecstatic, but I mean, it's like a long ways away.
I am ecstatic.
I mean,
I would like to play this game.
It's pretty much assumed that if the company like sold enough Dark Souls's, and they did, to make a PC port, then they're going to make another game after that. Whether or not it's called Dark Souls 2, or whether it's like Demon's
Dank
balls,
Souls
or whatever, right? Like
Dank Souls,
like arbitrary
Demon
new
Souls,
IP.
Dark Souls.
It doesn't matter to me
Disgusting
because
Souls.
Whatever they make next is gonna share, like the same like concept of awesome combat system that's hard. And so I'm excited for what the studio makes. So like the direct announcement doesn't do much for me because it's like I already knew
you assumed that that would be announced.
Yeah, I already knew they were doing that. I mean, I've read enough interviews with the guys.
Dilbert Souls.
All right, you just hipstered me. I get it. Moving on.
But it's like
no, you did. You're like, yeah, whatever. I've like already heard about
Mass
that.
Effect
that's over.
People. I mean, obviously, they're making more Mass Effect. We just don't know exactly what. We don't know whether it's another multiplayer game,
what we
whether
do
it's
know.
A sequel, I guess I wasn't... like Mass Effect 4.
It's being made by the multiplayer team, the team that developed Mass Effect 3 multiplayer, are building the...
And I mean, I guess I wasn't necessarily sure that Dark Souls, because it was known as like a super hard game, maybe not as accessible,
no, it did well.
That it did so well that there would be
it
a sequel
well
to
enough.
It.
I mean, yeah. It's... On the
You're psyched, admit it.
Yeah.
I am psyched.
Fucking
on,
bubble
on
over.
On the score of AAA, you know, on the level of AAA games, it's their lower budget than a lot, yeah. You know, but it's it was successful enough. They're making another. I'm stoked, yeah.
So I played a little more Assassin's Creed 3. I got to Boston. Obviously, I haven't played that much. I talked to Charles offline a little bit about this. You can't play this game for like an hour at a time. This is a game, because I'm not getting sucked in an hour at a time. Like, I need to sit down and play this for, like, 5 hours straight to get sucked in, and because I haven't done that, I'm just feeling, like, almost reticent to even turn it on, which I'm sure is a travesty, because I'm sure it's a fun game, but that is its weakness, that if you don't immediately drop a bunch of hours into it, because the beginning is a little weird and slow, it's not grabbing me, so... I feel bad, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, when you watch... when you sit down and watch a movie, you know, you're ready to commit 2 hours to it. And similarly, like, story-driven good games or whatever that I'm looking forward to, I generally prepare at least 2 hours.
Yeah.
Maybe three, ideally, to start it off, right? If you start with, like, a 20-minute session, and then you do another, like, 20-minute session... Yeah, almost any game might feel weird like that, and it's hard
it's
to
It's like
do
Death
justice.
By a Thousand Cuts problem, that yeah. It's just never as engaging enough to get past that 30 minutes, and then I just don't get into it.
The
anyway.
It has really good sound, there's a lot of dialogue, and if you don't give a shit about who everyone is and what's happening, and you don't know who you are and what you're doing, then
yeah,
I could see how you might not get sucked in, but... I didn't have that experience at all. I guess I played the first 4 hours in one sitting. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Like, I just sat down and I was like, fucking ships. I'm in England. I'm this other dude. I'm like doing shit. Not, you know, I look different. I'm in this opera house. I'm like, and then all the dialogue, I was like, this is cool. You know, all the future Desmond stuff. I was like, this is cool because I already know Desmond and I like.
Right,
his storyline.
Right, unless I play it through to like almost completion, I don't think I'll mention it again. Because if I don't mention it again, that means I've dropped it. But I did start a new game that I like. It's actually somewhat old. It's called Waking Mars. What's really interesting about this game, it's on iOS. That the game video game music soundtrack project that I'm working on right now is like. Wow, this almost seems like the big budget version of what this game this guy's working on could be. And it's almost like making me feel bad about that game because it's in such pre alpha. And this feels like what it might be if it had more people and time and money. I don't know. It's like really well produced. It's got, you know, dialogue, talking heads. You're on Mars. You're exploring.
You're awake.
You know, eventually, apparently, there's like a rover mechanical. Oh no, it's a mechanical thing you talk to. You know, like an AI. I don't know. It's really interesting and has really good mood. It's basically about gardening on Mars. I know that sounds kind of weird.
No,
but it's really interesting. I would recommend it even just only having played like maybe 20 minutes of it
so
far.
What kind of game is it?
It's kind of like an action adventure.
Okay.
You're an astronaut and you are exploring Mars and you're trying to, you know, see what's in Mars and you explore alien life and
like platform-y kind of
yeah,
thing?
Platforming.
Is it like
you know,
tap
you like
walk?
Start on the surface and you basically descend down into the caverns of Mars and you discover alien life and you solve
spoiler alert.
Little puzzles to move to different rooms.
Cool.
Yeah. And then I wanted to bring up something to discuss. So, you know, you've all played, like, online multiplayer bullshit games on phones, like Words with Friends, Letterpress, Draw Something, Carcassonne, any other multiplayer online game that has games and supposedly stats that are being tracked. My question is this: how do none of these games have, like, awesome in-game stats to look at? Like, the best thing they do is they might show, like, the last five or six games you've played and who you beat or who won the game. But beyond that, there's no, like, comprehensive every game you've ever played, who you played against, who won, how long the game took, how many moves, who had the highest scoring move, your win-loss ratio. This isn't even like an in-purchase, like an app in-purchase thing, which seems like a totally untapped market. Freaking nerds and geeks love stats. We all love looking at pretty graphs about our progress. How do none of these games have this option? What the hell is wrong with these people? And Game Center doesn't have them, if you're going to bring that up. They track achievements, leaderboards, and who else is playing it, but they don't have any of the things I mentioned.
So, it is a good point, but it is like one aspect of how all mobile games are on Android and iOS are shallow compared to console games. And this is, you know, ties in with what I was saying about like Vita games, like DGMAX being $40, mm-hmm. and phones always being free or $1 or $5. It's just like they could do that. It would take a little more time and a little more development and a little more money. And these games are, all phone and tablet games are generally really low budget and thrown together quickly.
Well, can you think of many examples mostly of console games that do that?
Yeah, like every racing game that you've played in the last 10 years has a stat screen that shows you like fucking your average speed, your total number of laps ever, your total number of minutes, hours, and seconds, like, driving.
Okay, racing games?
Racing games. Sports games, like, FIFA will tell you, like, how many goals, how many, like, friggin' goals blocked, how many blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
I think like Call of Duty has those kind of... Call of Duty Elite probably does.
The multiplayer, shooters, the Call of Duty multiplayer component totally has all that. It has,
you have to pay for it with Elite though, right?
No, it's free. And there's an app on phones and tablets that tracks all that and MMOs, shows you your level and shit like that.
They've got tons of... They're basically a page of stats with a chat room.
So I've actually thought about this very problem as a business model.
This because is, yeah, no game, money could be made here.
No game needs this more than StarCraft. Because in StarCraft, that shit is the key to your winning. It literally is how you win the game. And that knowledge is a major competitive advantage if you have it. And basically, the only way to get it is to play your 10,000 hours and become an expert at the game, or pay someone who has done that. And people do. People pay pros for coaching sessions. They pay hundreds of dollars an hour for that. And I have literally thought the only way to do this legitimately is to be Blizzard, right? But I am shocked that Blizzard has not done this, because it is a way for them to turn what is not an MMO into an MMO's recurring revenue stream, right? If StarCraft II is $60 a month plus a $5 a month, or rather, is a $60 game, then it's a $60 game one time. And yeah, you want a lot of people to keep playing it because you want them to play your game. But if it's also $5 a month to get incredibly great analytics and stat tracking about all your stuff, then it's like so much more valuable. I'm shocked that they haven't done it. They have a couple weird little, so much so that I have literally actively pursued, and attempted to pitch this into Blizzard to, you know, do fund it on my own somehow.
Wow.
It's like, it's so obvious. The only way to do it, and with games like StarCraft, there's a replay file, which is a few K of text that describes every move in the game. So, like, if you think about the stats...
Like chess or something.
the stats they have on a football game on TV or basketball, right?
Yeah.
They have huge amounts of stats on that, and they have people lined up at a table who are – there's a guy sitting there who's counting the number of rebounds. He's just like hitting a ticker, rebound, 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 rebound. It was, okay, this guy got a rebound, this guy got a rebound, this guy got a rebound.
It's a lot of manual labor.
Yeah, and this is a file. There's a freaking file that you can just run analytics against. Like, it seems so obvious. So obvious.
You know, and I just thought of another...
Like, do you perform better when you take early aggression builds versus economic ones? How much multitasking can you do? When you're, you know, do you spend more time pushing to the edge of the screen with your mouse to move over to the right? Or do you go over and click the minimap exactly where you need to see? Like, so obvious. So many things that can improve play.
I just thought of another place that I use that has the business model of you pay for more stats. All of these independent music sites like SoundCloud and Bandcamp, they both have the free model where you get like a certain amount of space or a certain amount of, you know, they put limitations and you can pay for like the gold or plus model and you get stats. I mean, you start out with basic stats, but if you want to know who's listening to your songs, where they're coming from, you can pay the pro model and you get to see that. I mean, I see Josh's point that the games, you know, the online, the like phone games that I'm talking about, probably the demographic is not me, is people who don't give a shit about the stats. But I feel like, but I feel like this information is there already. Like, all they have to do is just create an extra screen with a button that says stats and spit them out on the screen.
But it's not there already.
Well, I mean, but it's being tracked is what I'm saying.
It's not being tracked.
I bet you it is.
I bet you it's not.
You have to write extra script.
Yeah, you have to write code to track it.
Extra logic for keeping track of those variables.
So maybe they're not, but I don't feel like that is like a huge like extra thing for them to do. Like,
but if it adds 2 weeks onto your development cycle.
Okay, but the game is out. They can now add that as a patch.
But if there's not enough money to do so, or if they're spending their time on developing their next game that they're using to get money to to live.
Okay, maybe I don't need everything that I mentioned, but even just like comprehensive every game I've ever played
I totally agree.
How difficult would that be? Not difficult.
It's not that it's not.
They're just
difficult.
Not doing it. Like, they're purposefully not telling you that information for some reason. Or not keeping
track of it. No, there is a reason. The reason is it costs money to build those features in, and it doesn't return enough in terms of additional sales. It's sweet info for us to know. Like, it's so cool.
So you would want to know that, right?
Absolutely.
I'm not the only one. Would you want to know that?
Not necessarily. It depends on the game and whether it's
useful.
Well,
but if you were really into the game and you played it for a while, it would be nice to know that.
Not unless it's useful. It totally depends on the stat. I mean, the Forza Horizon screen that told me my average speed and, you know, that I've done over the last several hours of playing, totally useless. Like, okay, 75. Because a lot of the time I went 150, and a lot of the time...
Yeah, but that's a single-player stat. Like, these are all multiplayer competitive stats.
Any individual number, like, it has to be thought out and determined, like, whether or not it's useful, and then has to be scripted in to keep track of the variable and kept persistent over time, and, you know...
Yeah, I disagree. The more useless, the better. I would love for Punch Quest to have a super long stat screen that's like... number of punches thrown.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
like all that kind of bullshit.
On the other hand, if it's just a fucking page full of numbers, then it just looks cool.
It's just funny.
Then it's like a Final Fantasy 13 thing where it's just like number orgy makes you feel good, right? Because high scores,
distance travel,
lots of points of damage is awesome.
Right, but I'm specifically saying that I would think that for a multiplayer game, so much of the coming back to play more is the competitive, how am I doing, and how am I doing against other people, which I guess is why they have the achievements leaderboards, you know, that's like the global, how am I doing against other people, and I guess I'm more specifically asking for the how am I doing against myself stats.
So advanced...
I guess that's not as important.
Yeah, like, thoroughly fleshed out advanced multiplayer games always have that stuff. Right. Call of Duty's... And Halos and even Shadowguns, the Shadowgun multi. There's a dedicated Shadowgun multiplayer game. I don't know if you knew that. Like the original Shadowgun is just like a Halo-ish campaign or whatever. But there's one that's just multiplayer called like Shadowgun.
No research.
Something. What the hell is Dead
Shadow
Zone?
Shadowgun:no research.
Shadowgun:Dead Zone. And it's like multiplayer only. It keeps track of some stats. Like, you know, you level up and it's a more fleshed out shooter. I'm saying that the draw something type of game is as soon as they have the idea, they try to get that fucking thing to market as soon as possible so that nobody else beats them there. The newest one that we just played for a second is called Word Tag, and it's like the asynchronous taboo, and I think that's a good idea. And that game, the app is kind of shitty and slow, and I don't know if it's their servers or the app or whatever, but like it was pretty obviously just rushed out, like because they had the idea trying to copy the success of Song Pop and draw something, and you know, as soon as it's out, they might spend a little time bug fixing or whatever, but they're probably going to try to move on to the next idea, come out with the next app that's going to have like a short term fan base.
And I understand about that concept, but I mean, some of these games are really mature, like Words with Friends and Carcassonne. I mean, those are high budget games. You would think that they would care.
They're not high budget
for an iPhone game, for a board game on an iPhone. I think they're pretty. They're very, the art is really well.
Relative to a Call of Duty is like nothing. You know what I mean? Like,
I don't know. Fucking keeping a variable that says how many games I've ever won or lost does not seem like a major development cost. It doesn't. I mean, it's not important to them. It's not something they think they need to spend time on. But I think it seems like a total like douchebag move to not just give me that simple information. it's not like they have to have like a week long meeting and hire five coders to do that. But I feel like that would be their excuse. Like, no, that would be too much development to keep track of that kind of stuff.
I don't think you're thinking of the people that make these games the right way. You know what I mean? Like,
apparently not. Apparently, I'm giving them way too much credit.
Like the people that the guy that made Fez or something. Right. You know, like that was his fucking passion project. And if he could think of a way to improve it, he probably did it. You know what I mean? Like, and afterwards, if he could patch it to fix it, he would do it. Except he, you know,
can't afford it.
As we found out,
doesn't want.
There's
to.
These Microsoft impediments that prevent him from doing that. Right. Now, there's probably politics in some of those cases where, you know, either the ecosystem or the store or the cost of it or whatever. Like, they just can't make it happen. To some, or it just has to do with the politics of the people at the company, right? Mm-hmm. Like the coders have moved on to other projects, and the only reason for a patch is going to be a bug fix from now on that. And it's just that's the phase of development it's in. Bug fixes only. No more feature requests. It's done, right? Moved on. Sorry. Like, or the people that made it weren't passionate about it, and they're passionate about something else. You know, and so they're just like doing the bare minimum requirements, you know, or they just like they're not in a position where they want to bring it up in a meeting and like that would be nice, but I can't make a good justification for that increasing our sales at this point. Our sales are already going downhill. You know, we may need to move on to the next thing. You know, I don't know. It makes sense to me in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
it sounds cool. I would love it, but I always want more in all the games that I love. Just like we want more DLC, we want more expansions, the sequels to the games we love.
Well, yeah, and this doesn't even seem like a new request. This is not some revolutionary idea like, oh my god, it'd be nice to have a list of every game I played. Like, that is something, I don't know, that it just seems so basic to a game that is based on playing a bunch of games and knowing and keeping track of how well I did. Like, why do you only keep track of the last seven games? Why was the eighth one not important? That seems kind of arbitrary. I don't know. Whatever the reason is,
it's a cost.
It's annoying, and it seems stupid that
it's just
they
a
don't do it.
It's just a cost they don't feel they recoup. That's
and apparently, all. They all agree because they all do don't do it.
Because especially if you're saying that it should be stored up in the cloud somewhere, that's server cost. Like that's an actual hard cost.
And you already have an account for most of these games. They're already keeping track of individual accounts that have information in them. One more variable that has my win loss ratio.
But if
that's
you're
a big
Zynga,
deal.
Yes, yes, yeah, it is. It is because it's a server cost, right? It's storage cost.
To write that extra, like, K to my file, right?
Potential millions of Ks to your file, right? And then it's, if the company is huge, like Zynga, right? Mm-hmm. They're all about shaving infinitesimally small bits of money across an entire enterprise and increasing shareholder value. If a company is small, like Fez Guy, then literally spending the extra 2 weeks that it would take to code that shit in, even if it's just going to be stored locally, and not have a hard server cost associated with it, might mean the difference between shipping a game now and eating or not. And so they're going to make that decision. So it's like this middle tier of developers who have a little money but not a ton. You know, it's just this, and those people, you know, it's just, is it worth the time, right? It's kind of cool to have. Whenever a game does it, I'm like, oh, that's fun, and I go in and check it out occasionally. But I can't say that there's really a game where I go and use it all the time, and I think it has a big impact on gameplay.
Yeah, if you give us like the best case examples.
I'll tell you the best case example. It's StarCraft. That would be a game amazing benefit.
No. The best case example of stats that have ever been made and have been super useful to you in the past, like that exist. Then, you know, bring that up and let me know. You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's because it just hasn't become the norm yet, and it's just, like, nobody's seen enough good examples of it, and it's not in their head at all. You know what I mean? Like, co-op became the thing, and then co-op was in a bunch of games just because there was, like, incentive or desire to put optional co-op in like a lot of games, and then like multiplayer became a thing, and so now all these like single player shooter campaigns or whatever like feel required to have a multiplayer component in order to
be considered a full game,
be considered worth their value, to keep people holding onto the discs, you know what I mean? Like,
I mean, hell, I think even
if it's not a trend,
even Windows Solitaire, which is how old, keeps track of every game you've ever played. Like I said, I'm not asking for some ridiculous feature request. This is something that is a trope, but in all these games, in the iOS market at least, it has completely gone away. So, it has become a non-trope.
I don't remember which one it was, maybe Song Pop or something, but one of them like intentionally wipes your stats every week. You know what I mean? Like,
unless you have the pro version or something.
It wants your progress to look like new. Reset every week. so you don't look like you have too much of an advantage over someone like permanently. You know what I mean?
Well, okay, but then you could just make it a local stat. It doesn't have to be a global stat that other people can see. It's a cool thing. I wish they had. It sucks they don't. You know, I'm not going to lose sleep over it, but the idea that, you know, it's not a technical limitation. It obviously is a marketing or financial directive that they don't do it.
Oh, dude, Punch Quest totally has this.
Doesn't Punch Quest have like a shit ton of stats?
Punch Quest has a shit ton of stuff.
Yeah, so
this is great.
Yeah, so other games...
I've killed 30,545 things in Punch Quest.
Yeah, other games can suck it.
Oh my God, I've played 13 hours of Punch Quest.
Really? God, wow. I think that's more than me.
Wow.
13 hours?
That's legit.
Holy shit.
It's a good game, man. It really is pretty fun. It's very addictive. Punching stuff is awesome.
Yeah. God damn.
Like, that's you know,
I've got
10 minutes a night over the course of many nights listening to podcasts, like 10 or 20 or 30 minutes in bed, right?
You know, another thing really interesting about Punch Quest is that it works in both landscape and portrait view. How many, like, games... Especially like side-scrolling action,
but it doesn't
games
work that well that way. It looks it's
well, but the
terrible.
Fact, but the fact that it is playable it this way is kind of interesting. Yeah,
but you would never want to do it.
You said how many hours?
13 hours. It's right at near the top.
Kills, distance, farthest from playtime. Yeah, 4 hours. Jesus, you're a monster. And I thought I played a lot. Anyway, all right, enough of that. So yeah, we had a main topic for this episode, but I'm not really sure, because this, if we go into the spying guide
we went
thing
pretty long,
we'll be talking forever. There'll be another hour or so.
We'll do it next week.
Yeah, you'll probably have bought all your gifts by then, but we'll still tell you what to buy next week.
Well, do you want to do like a top three? Let's each do a top three so people can...
I have not ranked them, so
we'll
I would pick three random ones.
Three fun ones.
Because
otherwise, next week it makes no sense.
So this one, if you are also thinking about getting into the podcast business like the Escort Mission has been doing. By the way, go to our website, theescortmission.com. Check our social media. Send us email.
Amazon link.
Click on our Amazon link.
We've been looking in, or I've been.
Because you're going to be buying things.
I've been looking.
This is a whole segment about buying things.
Yeah, I've been looking.
I'm going to interrupt you again.
Two ways. And one more time. To do the podcast, not just from where we're sitting in my downstairs bedroom, but using a portable recorder. Zoom has a very nice line of portable digital recorders, the H2 and the H4N. I think they differ mainly by a number of inputs and maybe features, but they both seem like an interesting way to potentially do this show on the road, and that would be awesome if someone were to buy that for someone that they could then use that for such purpose. So that's my one. Chaz?
Oh, we're just doing one? I thought we were
doing three. Oh, you want to do three? Not a surprising choice, but hey, Minecraft. Maybe you played it, but maybe you haven't. This game's gone through all the iterations. It's actually up to like 1.4.5, but they still keep adding stuff like every couple months. Like, it's the game that keeps getting better and more features.
Are they making money through microtransactions yet?
They're hugely successful. I don't know if it's microtransactions.
No, they just sell licenses for $27 and...
They made fucking millions.
Now? It's up to $27 now. Holy yeah.
It was 25 on Xbox, and that was the most copies they've. That's their lead platform now.
Holy shit!
Yeah,
yeah.
They're
so
huge. It's huge.
But the business model is so weird that they just keep adding free stuff
yeah.
to it.
Yeah, like I paid for it year or two ago, and I keep getting free
they're
stuff.
They're not getting more money out of the same customers. They're just getting more customers.
Yep.
It's yeah, crazy.
But still, that game is awesome. And
that's part of how you get a lot of new customers, I know, is people saying like, oh my God, you get all this free shit all the time.
It is such an unusual business model. Yeah. Not many people can replicate that.
That is still a good game. You should, if you haven't played that game, you have to at least try it out. And this is totally for shits and giggles kind of a thing, but it would be pretty sweet if I had the Logitech Wireless Solar Keyboard K750 for Mac. Which actually lets you connect it up to, I think, 3 devices. So you can actually, I think you can switch it between your Mac, your iPhone, and your iPad at will, like pressing a button, and it just works for all of them.
Why is it so funny?
Because that will make a great gift for all your relatives.
What? I mean, it's wireless and solar. Okay. I mean, you like stop wasting electricity and let the sun do your bidding.
No, it sounds cool. I don't know. Is this.
Okay, Josh, tell our listeners what you should have, what they should buy if you were
I think Cards Against Humanity makes a really cool gift. You could either buy the set for like $25 or $30 or something, or you just print it out yourself for free, plus the cost of printing and cutting. And
if you have new cards
cool.
for the holiday.
And there's new holiday cards, right? Mm-hmm. You could donate money to them if you want to download them for free. Plus donation. And that shit is funny. It's like apples to apples, but with a really dark sense of humor. With all
yeah, if
kinds
you want
of
to
introduce
it is
kind of
NSFW.
If you want to introduce
your
relatives or your friends to the darkest corners of their psyches, the dank, deep places they don't show to others.
They're a good friendship test.
Okay, and then my one gift, game gift suggestion, if you're going to get a gift for a gamer, I think that the sleeper hit of the season is Sleeping Dogs.
Because
it's cheap now, and man, it's just fun to punch dudes in that
game.
And
they probably haven't played it.
And they probably have never heard of it.
It's a good game.
And you just drive cars in Hong Kong and punch dudes real good. It's a fun game. And thirdly, the Sriracha Cookbook looks pretty fun.
Is that from the oatmeal? Because he's big on sriracha.
I don't think so. It's just this is a whole cookbook full of recipes that feature rooster sauce.
It's got to be from the sriracha people, right?
I guess so. I don't know.
It better be.
I haven't read it. It
actually
just looks
doesn't
cool.
Have to be.
I thought that would make a good gift for anybody.
Sriracha recipes.
Anybody who likes spicy stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Chaz.
So the Settlers of Catan 15th Anniversary Edition is out, which is wooden. All the pieces are wooden, except the cards, I would assume.
But what about splinters, Chaz?
You could potentially murder someone with this set.
Not safe for under 5.
But yeah, it's like super high quality wooden version with cooler pieces and, you know, roads that kind of look like
how
roads.
Much is this coolness?
I have no idea.
Oh.
I don't know. How much was everything on your list?
Well, I'm just saying, like,
No, how much was it?
Special editions could cost way more than the normal one, and I thought I was curious.
Yeah, it just seems cool.
If it's expensive.
Right. If you have a significant female in your life,
Your mom?
Your mom, your wife, anyone in of that nature, an S.O.
Cousin-in-law?
MoMA, the New York Museum of Modern Art, has an online store that has a bunch of really cool jewelry, really cool women's jewelry that is actually pretty reasonably priced. You know, it's not like $500 for a tennis bracelet or $1,000 or, you know, $10,000. Like, reasonably priced stuff, but also very cool. And, you know, it's obviously it's curated jewelry collection that is all really cool stuff. Check Sweet. That out. And to pick one other third thing, kind of gaming related. Fuck, I have a lot of cool stuff on here. Gaming related, semi-gaming related. Penny Arcade, actually. Their first party brand stuff. Have you seen the Penny Arcade first party, like, hoodies?
Polo shirts.
Polo shirts.
Yeah.
They have a hoodie that looks... It's not really a hoodie. It's just like a really cool, nice... high quality jacket that has the little Penny Arcade first party logo. So, but you know, it's very subtle. You can wear it to work, but also still has some
not cool to my work
gaming cred. You can't wear a hoodie to work?
No, it's business cash. Every day.
Hoodie not acceptable. It's like a really nice hoodie.
Is a hoodie business cash?
I could wear a hoodie to work.
That's not business cash. That's cash. That's cash all the way.
Cool. Those are three things.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sweet, we totally burned through that topic that would have taken an hour in about 5 minutes. Good job.
Instead, we spent a half an hour talking about stupid shit. All right, never mind.
Hey, nothing on this podcast
that's
is stupid
the,
shit.
That's how the show works.
Don't delegitimize our show, damn it. Okay, so that's our show. Buy those things using our Amazon link, please. There's no extra cost to you, but it helps us out so that maybe we could get that Zoom H2/4N portable digital recorder and do the show on the road.
While typing notes on the Logitech solar.
The Logitech wireless solar keyboard case infinity for Mac, you know? And in our downtime, we'll play some Minecraft. That's our show. Go to our website, mail, social media. Send us more mail. Thank you very much. That was awesome. We would always love to hear from you about anything. About anything, yeah. Any parting thoughts?
No.
And
love ya.
You guys are entertaining. All right, we're out late.